Are you coming to the tree? Are they strung up a man? They say we run free. Strange things that happen to you, stranger would you be? We met and lived right in the hanging tree. Are you coming to the tree? Drift and call.
All right, welcome to the State of Games. I'm Dice Hate Me.
I'm Get Louder.
I'm Puppy Shogun.
And I'm JJS1.
And we are a podcast about any and everything related to board and card games. Welcome to episode 104, or as we like to call it, the one about Unpub 6.
Yeah!
Bet you never saw that one coming. Yeah. Yeah, this is going to be an interesting podcast. Okay. So, this year's annual Unpublished Games Festival, or Unpub 6, was held on April the 9th and the 10th in Baltimore, Maryland. And since we were all there, we'd like to recount our many adventures and all the games that we played. But first, Daryl, why don't you give us a few interesting facts about Unpub and how it went?
Well, it was, as you all can mention or figure out from the fact that it's called Unpub 6, it was the sixth year of our annual Unpub convention. And we don't have many numbers, unfortunately, from the first few. But we started having numbers as of Unpub 4, because that's when we switched to an Eventbrite system. So I could tell you that Unpub 4, our RSVP was 80 people. At Unpub 5, including the Kickstarter backing at this point, it was 752 RSVPs.
That's quite an increase.
And then Unpub 6, it was 1,217.
Woo!
Yeah, so boom. We had a total attendance of a little over 1,100, so it was a little bit tall, a little bit more than the first year, or than last year. Not much more. And honestly, I think it worked out better because we had a much larger space. We had more tables. We actually went from 60 to 88 designer tables this year. I say 88. We had 90, but a few didn't show up. So we had 88 tables, and it kind of spread the crowd out a little bit better, I felt. I mean, it was definitely points where designers were not getting away from their tables. But then there was points where they were able to get away real quick and do what they needed to do.
Yeah, it didn't feel as packed as last year, but that, I think that was a good thing, too, because everybody didn't feel like crowded. It wasn't super hot in there.
Yep.
Yeah, so it was a little more comfortable.
Yeah, and for everyone that was there, you saw, if you didn't see it last year, unlike last year, we had one giant room this year for everything. So we had the vendors in the same room, the tag tables, the regular tables, all one giant hall, and that was that.
That was far nicer.
Yeah, oh, I totally agree. It was just, even from a showrunner standpoint, and not just for me, but for the staff, it was just nice to be able to, like, walk up on that central stage and go, yep, I can see absolutely everything that's going on right now, and then step off the stage. So that was very nice. And the audio, there was no audio issues this year like we had last year. Of course, we paid a lot more for the audio this year.
I think it was worth it, though.
It was. Bruce helped us with audio last year, and he runs the Party Gamecast. Right. So he helped us with the audio last year, and it worked for the space that we had. Unfortunately, there was only two monitors and two rooms. So we had one monitor in each room, so it wasn't exactly the best, but it worked. It got by. This year, we knew a two-monitor setup wasn't going to help, and running extra cables all over the place. They had the ceiling speakers in this room, so we're like, you know what? Let's just do it. And, yeah, it definitely helped tremendously. Everyone could hear everything. So, but yeah, I'm incredibly biased. I thought it went very well. I'm very excited that the growth is still going, that the demand is still there, and that, you know, are securing next year and such. So
tell us about next year.
Oh, you want to know about next year?
Sure, I'd love to hear about next year.
So Unpub 7 next year, we'll be back in the exact same hall, exact same everything, and that will be on St. Patrick's Day weekend 2017. So from March 17th to March 20th, we will have Unpub 7 at that hall within that space. We are adding in, there was a designer check room, more or less, that we had this year, which was something we had an idea about. We thought, let's make it a break room. Then we're like, no, let's make it a check room, because if they don't have, if the designers don't take breaks, we still want the room for something. And so we thought, let's get a check room, get stuff out of the aisle. And that way people don't lose their suitcases like they did in years past. Strange. And so that was Leslie's brainchild. And I thought that was probably one of the best touches to Unpub 6.
Yeah, it worked really well.
I mean, it was a whole come in, drop your stuff off, get a number. We number your stuff and we're guarding it. Like, that's it. And it worked so well that actually in Unpub 7, we're doing it again. We're also going to add on two additional rooms. So we're going to have one room that is just for checking bags and boxes, and that's it. Like, that's going to be locked down the whole time. We're going to have one room that is going to be a designer break room. So we are going to have a legit designer break room or meeting room, whatever. And then we're going to have a third room that will be the game library that'll be set off to the side. And with that, we will also set up media tables for anyone that wants to do podcasts or interviews. And because open gaming only will happen from, you know, 8 p.m. on, like we did this year. And this way also, if publishers wanted a private place to talk for pitches or whatnot, they can use that space up until 8 o'clock at night.
It was nice this year. I was able to use it a couple. I was able to use that big table for a couple of meetings. So it was super nice.
Yeah, but this way, you know, you can have your privacy, you can have your chats, you can get your private play tests, you know, whatever you need to do. So there'll be two rooms available to do that. And so, you know, depending on if you want ears to hear certain things or not. So
super sweet. Well, yeah. Let me ask you a hot seat question.
Oh, man.
I felt, and I have felt in the past, but I didn't feel like we'd gotten quite to the size, I guess, with Unpub yet. But I feel like I just want an extra day. You know, I feel like if we had designer day on, let's say, a Thursday, and then we had playtests on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, because by Sunday it rolls around, people by around 3 o'clock, some people have to leave, things like that. It just would feel like we would get more out of the experience if we had that extra day.
Yeah.
Like, what can we do about that?
It's something we're looking at. We don't know if it's going to be ready for next year.
Boo.
It's not
trying to set things up for you.
I know it's not out of the realm of possibility. I will know more. We have a big staff meeting in June, and I'll know more after that. So the thing is this year we had a fourth room this year, or fourth day this year. We had Thursday, and Thursday we used for setup for us, and is because our sponsors, Ad Magic and Panda Game Manufacturing, they said, you know what? No, you buy the fourth room. You know, we'll give you the extra money to get the fourth room so you have a setup day. And that way Friday can even start earlier. And we're like, wow, okay, you guys are super generous. This is great. So that's what we did. And we really ended up needing that day.
Oh, yeah. I don't know how you'd pull it off otherwise.
Right. And so to have the Thursday, that means we're going to have more money to even book a Wednesday. So we have to have Wednesday set up, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I want to push for the four.
Welcome to the big leagues, dude.
I know. I want to push and have the 4 day because, as people mentioned, you add the fourth day and it's officially a convention. Like, it's officially UnpubCon. That's
right.
It.
Right.
Because being in a convention center evidently isn't enough anymore. It was last year. But we are interested in it. We have the interest to do it. We hear everyone wanting it. A lot of the surveys said, can we, you know, push everything so we have 3 days of playtesting? We're all for it. It's just the money has to be there. To be perfectly frank, the money has to be there.
Piece of cake. That's what TC's for.
That's all I do.
That's all he does. And he does it well. So
actually, Daryl just goes, oh, hey, I got, like, you know, another sponsor for, like, $3,000. And I'm like, oh, cool, I got one for $50.
I did.
That's cool.
That email chain was hilarious because TC's like, what am I doing? I'm knocking down doors and, like, you just show up and say one word. And it's like, oh, $3,000. I don't know how he does it either, to be honest with you.
Seriously. We're going to put tickets and everything up on May 1st. And with that, we're putting all the sponsorships up as well, like right off the bat. And the whole point of it is we're going to be transparent. Like, we don't really care if people see what the sponsorship levels are and how much the money is. If someone gives money more than the sponsorship level, you know, we don't necessarily have to tell you that. But that way, it's just a level of transparency that we want with the organization. So we really have nothing to hide. We're not being sneaky or shady. I mean, hell, we're filing for a nonprofit. We're in the middle of it. So our numbers will be public if anyone ever asks for them. So, yeah.
Why would anybody ever ask for your numbers?
I have no idea.
No, I'm just saying that, yes, somebody might ask you for your numbers.
Yeah, especially now that I said that.
Right.
Okay. I have a question.
Please.
So.
Oh, yeah, it's your first time coming.
Yeah, it was. It was awesome. But with it changing to St. Paddy's Day weekend, does that mean we're going to miss out on all the glitter and hairspray?
Oh, man.
All right.
That was epic. Yeah.
I have to say one thing right now. TC is a jerk.
What?
Of course. Yes.
So TC tweeted out, like, oh look, they're lining up the Unpub cheerleaders. And there were some people that were like, I don't know how I feel about that.
Oh, no.
Girl power. And I'm just like, whoa. They're not really Unpub cheerleaders. Like, we would not bring in cheerleaders.
How could you misconceive? There's literally like 400 people in that.
I know, but I'm like, No. I'm probably not bringing you. No.
You gotta explain to the listeners what we're talking about.
Right. Also, cheerleading is a sport, by the way.
That's right.
Yes, but I know, but it was just like all of a sudden they were like, how dare Unpub do that? And I'm like, we're not. Like, not false alarm. So what happened was that there was a cheerleading competition.
Youth cheerleading competition.
Yes, they were junior high or younger, and younger. Not or. They were definitely and younger, and it was right below us. But the issue was they were warming up everywhere. They were like roaches. They were in every single nook, cranny, and corner of the convention center, warming up, practicing their cheers. When you were coming up the escalator to go into Unpub, it was raining glitter. I crap you not. It was horrifying. And if you ever watched Toddlers and Tiaras,
that show was
horrific because of what they do to those girls. Their cheerleaders were dressed up like that. They were painted up like beehives and 40-year-old makeup and stuff. I'm like,
giant bows in their hair, too.
Tall hair, like 6 inches. Yeah. 8 inches high.
And these are easily like 10 or 12 year old girls. I'm like, what the hell? And here's my thing, and you guys may not know this. I was a cheerleader in high school, and I did not, like, our squad didn't do any of that crap. And so I'm just like, this is, what the hell
most
is this?
Most high school cheerleading squads don't do that stuff.
I've never seen it before. Like, we went to regionals, we went to states, and I've never seen that. That was the first time I've seen it.
Welcome to the new world.
All I can say is some of my favorite uncomfortable stories came from that weekend.
Yeah, totally.
conversations. Sure.
Well, every time I had to go to the bathroom, you have to go around the other side of the hall to the men's room, and every cheerleader in the world, it seemed like, was like right outside the men's room door, and you had to try to navigate them, and they were doing their little flips and their little like routines. Yep. And
avoid the hairspray clouds.
It was nuts. It was absolutely insane.
And you know what? I will say, it's the first convention I've been to where the men's room did not smell the worst. Because we had to walk by the cheerleaders' bathroom to get to the back entrance for the staff for Unpub, and it was...
If somebody had lit a match, the whole place would have went up.
Oh, no doubt.
And Ruth and I were talking because we're like, at a board gaming convention, we would think we wouldn't have to wait in line in the bathroom as women. The one time we wouldn't have to wait in line, because there's so many more men than women, and we had to wait a lot.
Hey, you know what? I finally brought equality to the board game convention.
And there was one point.
Real.
There was one point when I was sitting playing a prototype, and my butt was vibrating because the bass underneath us from the competition music was so strong. My chair was shaking.
That is awesome. That is brilliant.
But what was actually cool was that at one point I looked around and I saw a young cheerleader with. It must have been her mom and her sister, and they were actually in playing a prototype, so that was pretty cool.
Yeah,
someone was having a breakdown to try to pick up Zuloretto.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Oh, what?
Yeah, like the little girl, the cheerleader girl, wanted the Azuleretto, and they didn't have it in the store.
And she was losing it.
She was having a
tantrum.
She wanted Azuleretto at Carl's.
Wow.
And he's like, "Oh, sorry, I don't have that one."
Parents are trying to console her, but she's like, "I want it."
Well, go her for knowing Azuleretto. I mean,
no, that's what we were saying. Yeah, it was brilliant. Kind of cool.
Yep, it was awesome. Carl will have to keep it in stock next year for when we have the St. Paddy's Day. Oh my gosh, who's going to show up for St. Paddy's Day?
We got to figure out something. We need a good sponsor to help have a cocktail hour.
I can help with that.
Uh-huh.
And wasn't there also a magic tournament going on at the same time? And I don't think I saw any of those people.
There was a magic tournament going on Hall G, which was the opposite end of the convention center.
Oh.
And actually, we did have quite a few people coming over once they got eliminated. We had some Star City Games staff come over. So that was pretty cool. And I told Carl ahead of time, so he stocked card sleeves and things like that. So
he was
prepared. So
that's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, well, let's move on so we can start progressing through the days. So on April 8th, that was Friday, so mm-hmm. I was mentioning that it would be nice if we had 3 days, but it's cool that we had an entire day on Friday. It's Designer Day. And basically, it's held for registered game designers and VIP playtesters. So it started out with a breakfast reception, which was really nice. That was cool. Followed by four forums or panels, three of which I emceed. Hopefully, I did it successfully.
Zach.
You did good.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I couldn't hear. I was in the other room.
Yeah, exactly. TC's like, screw the panels.
I didn't hear any of them.
Well, I heard all of them. I stayed for every single one of them. Because I'm diligent. As an MC, you don't abandon your post.
Well, they're going to be put online, right?
I hope so.
I hope so, too, because I missed them for some reason.
So, they were all good. I'll just run through them really quickly, and if there's any... I mean, Jessica, were you in there for all of them?
Yeah, I was.
Okay, good. So, you can touch on some of these. So, first was a Panda's Perspective by Brent and Matt, both from Panda. Brent Kenny is our primary... what do you call it, Daryl? What do we call those? Account managers for Dice Hit Me Games, Greater Than Games when dealing with Panda. And it was nice to kind of get them to come and talk about what you should be thinking of if you're going to be Kickstarted or doing self-publishing and what you can look forward to with working with Panda. And Panda provides a lot of resources for up-and-coming companies. They've been very valuable in the past few years. Obviously, we've used them several times, but one of the things that's most valuable from them is answering questions but getting quotes. So you can get a quote from Panda for free, and it'll kind of give you the overall cost of what your game might be on the market. And matter of fact, even if you're not planning on publishing it yourself, if you want to contact Panda and say, look, I'd like to do this, and considering that I might want to self-publish, but I'm not sure yet, I just want to know how much it would necessarily cost. And as a designer, you'll have that knowledge, so you can either make the decision for yourself, or if you're approaching a publisher, you can say, well,
right.
I've already got a quote for this. And it streamlines the process incredibly. So that was a nice panel to have, especially to lead off the morning. A lot of people got into that. They also was a Q&A session, so several people who either were considering Kickstarter or were involved in the Kickstarter process were able to ask questions of them and it seemed like it had a lot of value to it.
That was actually my favorite panel of the day. I thought it was really interesting how much they will help you, figure out what it will take to produce your game. And I didn't know they did all that. They call them manufacturing companies. So I assume they just make it, but there's all this prep, so much more prep stuff and further earlier in the process than I expected for them to be able to help you along. So that was really cool. I thought it was great for, somebody who's maybe a fledgling designer who's wanting to publish or maybe wanting to get into self-publishing. It's good to know that there's a company out there that can help you along in that way.
And that they're pretty much, they're just super high quality.
Yeah.
I was about to say the best, and then I was like, you know what? We have other sponsors. Probably not say the best, but they just have really, really good, quality. Always like, I don't know, just always the same level of quality too. You don't get like a stinker.
Yeah, they're dependable.
Yeah.
And that's what's important. And we've depended on them for years, and we hopefully will continue to do so. And it was nice to be able to get them to come and answer questions. And it was also great, naturally, to have them as one of the main sponsors, the Adamantium level sponsors.
And they're Canadian, so they're nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. The one great thing about them this year was that panel was their idea. And they do something similar at Gen Con. And they were like, do you think that would work at Unpub? And I was like, hey, with your sponsor, if you want a panel, you get a panel. You just let me know.
Right.
And they were like, yeah, let's try it out. And a lot of people are saying, like what you said, Jess, that it was like the most interesting. Because it was different than any of the panels we've had.
Really?
Yeah. Typically, we do the state of the industry, and then we had the Q&A with the designer legends.
Mm-hmm.
And so this one was an interesting addition, I felt. So, once again, I wasn't there to listen to it, but I've had a lot of people compliment that panel specifically.
Yeah, it was really good. It was my favorite.
Yep.
Even though I will never use them because I'm never going to design the game. So.
Well, but that's the thing, though, is you still found it interesting because yeah. You could see behind the scenes. Myself, you know, it's like everything they were going to say I knew already, but only because I'm a publisher and I've worked with them so closely. But I knew everything they were saying was just super valuable to the audience, and so that was what was really nice. So, afterwards, we had Carl. And Carl didn't quite know what to do with himself. He was like, Carl is the owner of Gameskeep, and of course has been coming since Unpub 4, right, Daryl?
Yes.
Yeah.
He has been our main game vendor since Unpub 4.
Yeah. Yeah, he is super awesome. He knows, he has a great perspective on retail, distribution, and this was, to me, the most, the best panel to me. Because I like to get retail perspectives, especially people from retailers that I trust and respect. And Carl's definitely one of those people. So for him to come up and basically talk about a lot of the parts of the industry that people don't necessarily think about, which is long tail, marketing your games to marketing those games to your friendly local games store. You don't just have to go through the distribution channels. And he was a lot of fun to come up and talk about that portion of it. You know, you don't think about your brick and mortar retailer as much as you possibly should from a Kickstarter perspective. And he was also able to give a freshness for the Kickstarter perspective. So I enjoyed Carl. I'm glad he's able to come. I asked him again after the show. I was like, Carl, are you going to come back next year? And he's like, as long as I'm invited. And I was like, Carl, I don't think you will not be invited unless you go out of business, because he had the great, you know, the store of all of his stuff. He was kind enough to bring all that stuff down, and I know he sold a ton. I
even bought a game.
So did I. Yeah, there you go. If TC bought a game, then it was successful.
What'd you buy?
Me?
Yeah.
I bought Mombasa.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Which I then played, and I really like, so I'm glad I bought Mombasa.
I bought so many games that I'm slightly ashamed.
I bought a sister game too.
I did not get Mombasa. I wanted to get Raptor, but Katarsky got the very last copy of Raptor.
Oh, no.
I got Ticket to Ride America because someone's borrowed Leslie's that is signed by Alan Moon. So we bought them Ticket to Ride to get our copy back. Like, here, give us ours. So we picked that up. I got Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective. I got both Time Stories expansions. I got Elder Signs, Omens of Ice, which, oh my god, if you thought Gates of Arkham was, like, difficult, that's nothing. That's like preschool compared to this version.
I almost bought that one.
But it is insanely, stupidly hard. And, we got that. We got, I got the Camel Up expansion. I got...
Dang, dude.
We walked out with a giant box full of games. Like, a giant box full of games.
No, so, I won't say first Bonanza. I won't say that I should have bought more, but only to support Carl would I have considered buying more. But he had Quadropolis, the New Days of Wonder release, and had it before it was supposed to be in retail. So I was like, yeah, how can I pass it up? So I got the last copy of that. Have not had a chance to play it yet. It looks super cool. So anywho. Thanks to Carl for being there, not only vending and allowing Daryl to spend so much money that it's just insane.
Yeah.
Yep.
But also for wanting to do a panel and sharing so much with the behind the scenes of the retail market.
Yeah, I liked his talk too. It was cool. I didn't know that you could, you know, actually go into a store and just ask to, you know, display your game and sell it and work with, you know, a game shop to just do that without going through like a, you know, publisher and distributor and all that kind of stuff. So that was interesting. I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah, and it's a little harder to do that to maintain a regular, you know, publishing entity, because you really do have to to depend on the distributors. But he also touched on that too, in keeping a healthy relationship with certain distributors and ones that a lot of friendly local game stores like to work with. So it was very valuable from a publishing standpoint, which is what I was waiting for, because I wanted to hear what Carl had to say. So after Carl rolled into the state of the industry, this is something we've had in the past. It's usually a smattering of different people throughout the industry. So we had Scott Gaeta from Renegade Games. We had Brent Kenny from Panda. Carl was on this one again. Isaias Vallejo from Daily Magic Games. And Andrew Tolson was there representing Ad Magic and, of course, his Print and Play Productions company, which is part of Ad Magic now. So all kinds of different perspective on the industry itself, and basically was just asking questions about what was going on in the board game industry. I led a couple of questions just to get the ball rolling and then opened it up for Q&A. And one of those that I thought everybody answered really great was about the whole Asmodee. You know, we talked about it in the podcast, so we won't get deeply into it. A lot of the same things are rehashed there. But, you know, Asmodee saying they're going to not necessarily fix prices, but they're going to start managing what their prices are post in retail and through distribution. So everybody had a different take on that, but all pretty much the same, that it was probably a positive move.
Yeah.
And I thought that was good to hear, because I wanted to get that perspective out of that. That was the most important one for me to kind of ask the panel. And then the Q&A was a lot of the typical, like, well, what do you think about X, Y, or Z? I also brought up a little bit about Kickstarter, because I wanted to get Carl kind of running. I wanted to get his engines going, because Carl's not always been the biggest fan of Kickstarter, but he brought it back to a realistic level of saying, like, you have to recognize that Kickstarter's there, and as a retailer, it has to be in such a way that, you know, you can adapt. And he would talk about some of the things that some Kickstarter campaigns do that really tick off retailers, and some that other campaigns do that really, you know, make retailers feel inclusive. And that was important to hear as well.
And then I think ultimately he just said, well, at least it's getting, you know, exposure of the game out there and people know about it. And then when they see it in the store, they can buy it.
Yeah, ultimately he's like, it brought, he said, like, so many percentage of the games that he has in his store wouldn't even exist or be there if it wasn't for Kickstarter. So
right.
He recognizes the value in it, which is good, because if you don't as a retailer, you have to at least recognize that part of the value of Kickstarter. So that was a good panel. It's always a good panel. I just love hearing what different people have to say about the industry itself. Since TC and Daryl didn't listen to that one either, we'll move on to the next one.
I was just setting everything else off.
I'm just chomping at the bit to talk about my UmPub experience. So
we're getting
I'm just
there.
Trying to get through these lame parts.
We're so getting there. These are good. Now, oh, you're about to talk. You're saying Eric Lang and Rob Davio are lame. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I should have been on this League of Legends thing.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, it's not very objective. It's just like, we're going to just call up some designers that have designed a couple of games.
Yeah, only the number one game and then the hottest games. Yeah.
Only those. Yeah. But anyway, so the next panel, of course, was League of Legends. Stephanie Straw stepped in and emceed this for me, because I felt like she had that perspective that it would be nice to ask Rob and Eric. Anyway, Eric Lang, of course, and Rob Davial on this. Rob Davial being one of the legacy king, so Pandemic Legacy being number one, co-designing it with Matt Leacock, and then Eric Lang, of course, having one of the hottest games out there today, Blood Rage.
Yep.
And with just such a storied history of gaming on that. So they sat down, Stephanie asked them a few beginning questions to kind of rev them up, and it was kind of cool, because she pitted them against each other, like saying, you know, Eric, what would you do to design a legacy-based Euro type of system? And Rob is like, what would you do if you developed, you know, like a miniatures-based game? You know, so that was kind of fun. And everybody, of course, loved that one. That one ran a little bit longer than normal, and typically, like last year's Q&A with Richard Mike was, I mean, it just went forever.
Yeah, well, this one we also scheduled, because we learned from the previous year that this one will go long. And so we accounted for that in the schedule. And this is also why we didn't really put anything after it. So
Yeah, which is good.
I think that was probably a good choice. Everything seemed to last the appropriate amount. And we wrapped this one up around 7:30, 8 o'clock, and then people broke for dinner. And then we had open gaming for the rest of the night, which was a good way to round out Friday. You know, last year we had the designer dinner, which was fun, but it kind of roped us into being in one place at one time. And already people were splitting off to do playtesting or gaming in the other room versus sticking around for the panels. So it's usually nice, or I thought it was nice this year to give people choices. And I didn't feel like we had people like just shirking the panels whatsoever. Like sometimes people would be like, oh, I want to hear this panel. They'd stop and then come in and listen to one versus the other. And I think that's nice. Mm-hmm. So overall, it seemed to work pretty well. Except for the, you know, couple of the slackers who just don't care about anything. So. except their own games.
Yeah, we're just playing games, you know, doing the playtesting thing at Unpub.
Hey, trust me, if I was not emceeing, I probably would have been doing the same thing. But it was good. I loved the fact that I was able to be in there and interact with everyone and listen to what all the panels had to say, and I enjoyed that. So,
see, the one thing that a few comments have said is like, oh, the League of Legends was really cool, but they kind of said the same stuff that Lanius and Fitzgerald said last year. Well, and I was like, I was a little shocked by that because I figured they'd offer different perspectives and such. So it's something that we're going to try to work towards changing for next year.
I think it would be, you know, we call it League of Legends or Design Legends. I think it would be interesting to pull in maybe some new blood, you know, just to put a couple of people or vary the panel up. You know, you got one super legend.
TC's not going to get on a panel, Chris. Let it go.
I'm just trying to help out here.
I was already on the panel before. I don't have to worry about this anymore.
I was too. I've been there, done that.
See? Yeah, done. We're done with this. We're done with Unpub.
Right. All right.
I go to Unpub for fun. I'm independently wealthy.
All right. So let's move on to kind of the heart of Unpub, which is playing games.
And yeah.
So, naturally, TC, you wanted to talk about some of your games, and we'll get to that in a second. So,
no, not my games. I don't care.
No, we just want to talk about some games that we experienced, and we are going to try to keep this as brief as possible, but focus on the ones that we thought that were really cool, really fun. But anyway, Saturday and Sunday were the big days for playtesters to come in. They registered, they played games, they gave feedback, and they sometimes got rewarded with going and getting cool games from the, you know, the stage and everything.
Man, we had so many games this year.
Oh, it was a ton.
And some amazing, like LaGrange was one of them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's insane.
Yeah, so it was insane.
LaGrange.
Well, what? It was like...
No.
We had six copies of Lupin Chewy. You want that on there?
So, Saturday and Sunday, of course, are the big days for playing games. And so, when you go to Designer Day, you have some fun, you go out drinking afterwards, play games, whatever, is what happens. But you get up super early on Saturday because you've got your list. And I know Jessica had a list. And I, of course, had a list as well. But our lists are probably, we diverge in a few places because there are some games that I'd love to sit down and play. But as a publisher, I have to have a mindset of going forth and looking at games that could either be scouted or that I've talked to designers beforehand to be able to sit down and play them. And so I know our lists are going to be quite different. And TC, I know you've played a lot of your own games there, but you played some others that we'll get into. And Daryl, you didn't play anything. Yep. So just go ahead and take a nap and we'll poke you with a stick in a minute. right, exactly. But one thing that I also had to be mindful of is that I had a couple of games that are in the library being playtested. So I have to go and check on the designers, make sure that things are rolling well, sometimes even running that game, for instance, Fate of the Elder Gods, which we'll talk about in just a little bit. But first, let's talk about the first game that all of us played on Saturday. And let's talk about Underground.
I
didn't play that game.
Except for Jessica. Oh, and Jessica. Daryl.
Wait, I thought you were in that one. Who was in it with us then,
Ruth.
TC? Ruth was.
Yeah,
and
Ruth.
Matt Wolf's wife, right?
Oh, Marcy. Yeah, Marcy played with
yes,
us. Yes,
Marcy.
Okay. Did you get a chance to play Underground, Jessica?
Nope.
Oh, that's too bad. So, TC, why don't you tell us a little about Underground?
So, Underground, everybody seemed to like, but it's really early. Underground is a game about punk rock in the late 70s, early 80s, back whenever it was like started for the first time. So it's about building your own punk rock band and all the problems that you have, both internally and then also everything that's about being a band. So touring and making music and doing all that stuff. But the focus of the game, since this was kind of the focus of punk rock and still is kind of, is the underground. And that's the idea that you are going around touring, but instead of just touring and doing gigs and stuff, you're building communities. You're building the scene in major cities across the US mainly, but then you can go overseas to like London and Paris and Berlin and Tokyo and stuff, if you get big enough, right? But then of course you're selling out at that point, and that's not a good thing for punk rock bands. So the idea is to become the most legendary punk rock band, whatever that means logistically, but in this game it's kind of points. But at the same time, it's, you can't, just because you make the most money does not make you the most legendary or release the most albums. It's about how you are remembered and the community you built for that music, right? So that's really the focus. And I think the main thing I got, it was awesome to get, like, so basically, we'll get into the, Chris can get into the playtest and everything and how he felt. But the night before, at the designer night, I played with Ruth again, and I played with Ben and Matt. Ben Rossett and Matt O'Malley. Because I was hoping to get a group of people together that I would feel kind of comfortable mm-hmm. playing for the very first time. Because this was the very first time. I had not even had a chance to solo play. Which is actually kind of difficult in this game because there's a lot of stuff going on per person, per turn, that you have to make decisions on. So it's really tough for me to play myself. And it was awesome to do that because basically that night I got to get rid of any fluff that made the game kind of slow down to a halt. We fixed like one thing that I hadn't accounted for. So we kind of fixed that, but we took a whole chunk of the game out, and it played better the next morning. Chris got a chance to play, and Ruth played again because she really liked it from the night before. And then, so that was cool because we had Marcy too, which I've met Marcy, but I think we played like one game at BGG Con one time. So it was kind of like an intro to getting other people. And then I played one more time with an entire group of strangers. So it was awesome, like just getting three different playtests with three like slightly escalating levels of comfortability with the game system was really cool. But what everybody seemed to like was the idea that this is kind of that punk is a virus, so it's kind of like pandemic in reverse.
It's true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when you play gigs and stuff in a city, if that city fills up, so depending on the size of the city, you have to play a certain amount of gigs and you can work together with others to do it. You score points for making a community, but then depending on how big the community is, which is like the cubes turn into discs, but the stack, you count how many discs are in the stack, and then that explodes to other cities, which can cause like interesting chain reactions. And I think most people just liked moving around and causing crazy chain reactions on the board, which was really cool.
Yeah, we had
that's that. What did you think?
Oh, me? Well, I mean, our playtest was interesting because we all kind of had different play styles, and which is, of course, when you have a game like that, it means you're on to something. When suddenly, you know, you realize you have variable paths to victory built right in, which is awesome. Also, like for instance, my band, Boston 2.0, was, and this is what's cool too.
Straight out of Boston.
Seriously, straight out of Boston. Every round, I would go back home to Boston, while everybody else is just out on the road. They're just like having a good time, partying on the road. And we're like, nope, we got to go back to Boston.
Yeah, but it was good. It kept you like solid. You didn't ever lose any money from being on tour. You just stayed there, and I think in the end, whenever we counted up points, you had the most points too.
I did, and that was going in. Obviously, you have to work out when there's multiple rounds. We played through a truncated round to see how it would work, and then we set our goals at that point, which was great to see where we're at. But I mean, the entire time we played, it was story after story. I mean, it was just fun. I mean, I had a lead singer. Her name was Stacy. I named her, but her name is Stacy. She had an addiction from the very beginning of the game. So she had an advantage, basically, to possibly make a little bit more money off of her presence whenever an album went live or something like that when you rolled the dice.
Was the only cure more cowbell?
No, the only cure for Stacy was more cocaine.
Oh.
So Stacy was coked up out of her mind the entire tour. She's like, let's go. And then, but the thing is like at the end of the day, whenever we were out on the road, she's like, we got to get back to Boston. That's where my dealer's at. So we'd run back over to Boston and everybody would stay because they could stay at Stacy's house. Doesn't really matter. And then she would get her hit and fix. And then we'd go back on the road again and back to Boston. So it was awesome. I mean, it was just so much fun to kind of have just the way the gameplay worked, to have that sort of story play out in your head, just with the simple mechanics and the flavor that TC had put into the game. And we were all getting into it and having some fun. It was really a great way to start out the Saturday morning, you know, managing my band with my coked out lead singer.
Yeah, yeah. And I think what's for people that are like listening, since like, you know, you got the family style podcast, right? So the issue with Underground is that it doesn't stop at a certain line, right? It goes past that line,
right? Because it's
so
punk.
So it's punk rock, so it's going to go past some safety zones that people have, right? So there is addictions in the game, and your lead singer can die from an addiction.
Yours did.
There's good things and bad things about the addiction. Yeah, and mine did. Yeah, mine did. Mine did in two different games. And when that happens, you have to get somebody else, and you have it's kind of a setback, but not that bad. But the other thing is, there's also these when you lose a lead singer or when your band's unhappy, you have these destruction, it's like self-destruction tile cards, and they give you a choice, and they're both bad. So it's like this thematic flavor thing, which I don't think we got too many of those in our game.
No, but it was enough to see how it worked, and I thought that was awesome, because you're like, I love when you have to make a choice, and when you're talking about thematics, you had the choice of, yeah, no matter what you choose, it's going to be bad, but you're going to choose your own level of bad.
Yeah, and in one game, man, was it Matt, or I can't remember, but somebody had a guy that really loved destruction. Right, very punk. Mm-hmm. So when the band was self-destructing, that's where he was happy. So he would score you more. So those self-destruct cards are actually worth points in the game. Mm-hmm. So you score points for self-destruction, which is punk, but he would score more points. So there was one game where someone was just going through those cards, right? And it was just very funny to see him like have to make terrible decisions every single turn, but no, he's going to score points for it. And yeah, it was very interesting.
Ruth got two in the same turn, I think, at one point, didn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. She had some really bad decisions she made on the road, which was great.
Very unhappy.
Yeah, but I mean, it was punk, man. You know.
But yeah, and the things that I got out of the playtest was just amazing. These are the first three playtests, so it kind of solidified the fact that I had a base system that was really nice with the touring, and that the meteoric rise on the charts was awesome. That you would roll an exploding die, and that
you made like 30 some dollars, yeah, in one turn or whatever.
Our best was 42 over three games.
That was crazy.
And yeah, so like somebody just rocketed way up to the top of the charts all of a sudden. Now they're like, and the idea of it is that that's not good, but it's not bad, right? Like it's not like it takes away opportunities from you to be crazy in the money. And it also like is good because now you can jet set across the world. So it's weird. So I just got a lot of good playtesting in, and now Underground 2.0, my next version, will be so much better. And hopefully I can streamline it and everything. We spent too much time talking about Underground, but it's a weird game. And I'm really happy that it actually worked, because it didn't break. We made it through a few rounds each time, and I told everybody that we weren't going to do a full game, and everyone was cool with that. And I got some, even with the people who I didn't know at all, just gave me a huge boost in ego, which I totally need. And And they were just, after they were done playing the first two or three rounds, they were like, oh, this, I love this, and this, and this. I was just super happy to get that kind of feedback.
I had a blast playing it. I'm glad it was my first one that I played on Saturday. And I'll be honest with you that it was, well, other than the ones I'd already kind of signed, it was my favorite. But
yeah. It's just different. It's just different. I don't think there was a game. Yeah, there was. It was weird too. There was five different rock games. Did anyone play another game about music?
Because there was like vinyl.
Five different ones.
Jessica and I got to play vinyl. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, talk about vinyl then. First,
Jessica, why don't you talk about vinyl, and then we'll go back and on your list and talk about.
You want me to? I was barely lucid when we were playing.
Oh,
it was so late.
Well,
I was losing it.
I want you to tell the story because then you can gripe about me griping.
It, honestly, you're going to have to explain it because
okay,
I can't remember.
Okay. So it's designed by Eric Alvarado and Brian Fisher. And it's basically what you're doing is you're going around and acting on the behalf of vinyl collectors. And what's at the top of the rows, there's a grid set out. And the grids, the actual rows of the grids represent music stores. And they have different vinyl records in their collection. And the columns represent... cards at the top where you've got to go and try to fulfill vinyl collections from these collectors. And so one of the great things about the game is that you're trying to balance your own collection versus if you want to start a new collection from someone else and try to fulfill those. You can, on your turn, you have several action tokens and you use those to move from store to store or reserve records or... actually buy those records, add them to your collection. And yeah, I think it was five total genres, if I recall correctly.
I think there was more. There might have been six.
Maybe, I'm not sure. But it's, you know, like, you know, country and R&B and things, or at least rock and roll. But it's kind of cool because each individual record has its own sort of art. It has that very vinyl feel. It's like, you know... You're playing the high fidelity world where you're going from store to store and you got to try to collect, and you're pressing your luck a little bit too, because between rounds, if nobody's on a specific row, then that record store's collection will just get wiped, because they're just like, you know, we're just going to sell them on eBay. So they wipe them off and a whole bunch of new records come out. So if you really needed some of those, you can't depend on that unless you try to make sure your token's there so it doesn't wipe at the end of the round. And that's kind of it. I mean, it's a set collection, a little bit of press your luck, a little bit of block your neighbor, a little bit of screw your neighbor, to be honest.
Wham, wham, wham.
No, I don't want to hear it.
Such a baby.
But it was fun. And, I mean, we did have a good play test because I gave Brian and Erica some good feedback on possibly what could happen in the last round. Like, there was one point, and this is every time I play a game with Ruth, this is going to happen. Like, she's going to screw me over at one point in the game. It just happens. I mean, there is no story except Underground, because we didn't get in each other's way because she was off touring London and stuff, and I was in Boston. But
it's a nice game, though.
It is.
You're really nice to each other.
You're usually nice to each other because you're destructive to yourself. Yeah. So, but in vinyl, there's possibilities for blocking. For instance, if you reserve a record at a store, you don't have enough that you could possibly... In order to collect the cards, you've got to, or collect the records, you've got to make sure that you have matching sets of certain criteria. And sometimes you may not have all those sets, but you want to reserve a record, so you can put an action token on top of that. But if somebody really wanted to buy that out from under you, they could use two action tokens and pay for all that. You don't expect that because action tokens are valuable. And... so I was set to my very next turn to buy that record, and Ruth goes, she just looks at me, and I knew exactly what she's going to do. She's like, buying that record. I'm like, I knew she was going to do it. But it happened in the fourth round versus the fifth round being the last of the game. And so I got angry, but of course, I was like, it was a good move. I recognize it. It's what you needed to do. It happened in the fourth round. It was totally fair. But then the fifth round, you're trying to maximize your score, and it seemed too easy to block people out. Like, Ken Grazier played a really dirty move But at the same time, if it had happened earlier in the game, I wouldn't have been as mad as I was at the end because there was nothing I could do to prevent it. And it also screwed me out of a bunch of points, and it didn't really help him all that much other than keep me at bay on points wise. Now,
well, would those tokens, like reserving something, even matter on the last turn?
Not on last turn. No, not really.
Just to block somebody.
Just to block somebody, yeah.
Yeah, so should it just be like, hey.
Yeah, pretty much what we agreed on for the very last round is that you can't do certain things in the game that you can do early in the game because it's just there's no way to come back from it. Yeah. And that was a good playtest. I mean, it gave them something to think about. And I said, and then initially I said, like, look, take this feedback we gave you to heart and go ahead and keep playing it the way you're playing it now and seeing if it affects many other people like it did me. And then you'll see if that mechanic needs to change or not. Don't initially change it. And that's something that we talked about in playtesting with the last podcast. That's something you need to realize, too, is like, don't just say to somebody, no, this needs to change, because you don't know. I was like, from a developer standpoint, it's like, I want you to be aware of those, but at the same time, don't just go ahead and change it based upon the fact that I got pissed in the last round, you know. Just see if it affects other people as you play test it, and then you can start tweaking it backwards, which I think is going to be good. But the overall game is fun.
Well, it just seems like you're not a very good vinyl collector.
I guess I'm just really not. I'm sorry.
I wish I could have played it one more time because I really was too tired. It took me forever to even realize what I was doing. I was kind of out of it.
You were pretty out of it. All right, so let's just move on because we have a lot of games to cover and we might not get through them all. But what was the first game that you played, Jessica?
The first game I played was my favorite of the entire convention. And that was Ben Pinchback and Matt Riddle's Songbirds.
I forgot to add that to my list, but it's really good.
It was so... And I only played it two-player. I played it just against me and Matt. Or me and Ben. But I loved that game. And what's funny is that I have no interest in birds whatsoever. And I was like, okay, I'll play your game.
You don't even like birds, do you?
I don't care about them, really. I mean, they're cute and whatever, but... So, I have no interest in birds or anything. You know, like, a lot of people are into bird watching, all that kind of stuff, but... So, I was like, but yeah, I'll sit down and play your game. And he explained how to play the game, and even as he was explaining it, I was like, this is so cool how thematic you made this little card game, you know? But in Songbirds, what you're doing, basically, is there are six different species of birds. I think it was six. And you're trying to collect a majority of birds in a species because, you know, with it being a prototype, the cards just had little dots on them. Some had three, some had two, and some had one. So if you have a majority in a species, then you can add up those dots and those are points. So in addition to that, in the middle of the table is a perch from a bird feeder, and there are two birds perched on one on either side. And then above the perch is the seeds coming down to, you know, feed the birds in the bird feeder. So there's four different seed cards, and those are worth points. They're worth varying points. And so during the game, you're basically playing cards so that you can collect birds into your set. You get extra points if you get the male and female version of the bird. And then with card play, too, you can end up going up the seed track and collecting seed cards. But in addition to seeds, when a seed card is taken, then a new card comes out from the deck, and then sometimes a crow can come out, and if you end up having to have to collect that card, that's minus 6 points at the end of the game. But then there's also a squirrel card, and then if you end up having to grab a squirrel card, at the end of the game, for every squirrel card you have, you have to randomly pull out two seed cards, and those don't count towards your score. But I just thought it was so cool and thematic how the seeds came down, and sometimes the squirrel was coming down to steal the seed from the birds and everything. And you always draw your hand of bird cards back up to four, and there's three laid out that everybody can see, and so you can kind of gamer the game too. Ben commented on me how he saw I was gamering it because I stole a card to prevent him from getting a male and female set.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, so it was, and it was quick.
How many did you play with? Did you just play with Ben?
Yeah, it was just two player, and it was great.
Yeah, I played with three. It was me, Ben, and Ruth.
Yeah, I'm curious how it plays at higher player counts, but two, it was perfectly fine, and it was, I enjoyed it thoroughly.
I thought it was great. I didn't get it. It didn't click until halfway through the game, but even then, I still won, I believe, if I recall correctly.
I want believe to. I did.
But it, I was kind of like asking every term, like, what happens when this squirrel hangs on, or not squirrel, when this bird hangs on here, and what happens when you do that? And, but once you step through the scoring and how things work and getting bird seed, about halfway through the game, it all just makes total sense. And it's an amazing, like, again, they're really good at coming up with these
it's crazy
card
to me.
Games.
It's, yeah.
And they're really, really good at them.
Yeah.
So I was thinking like, Chris, did you win because you had like the most seed? That seems like it would be your go to.
Yes,
thing.
That's pretty much what I did. I did absolutely everything I could to get the most seed and avoid anything else, which I did.
Yeah, and I think that's like it's a solid strategy. I just think that was like that's the tactical part that's good about the game.
I had the most majority of species. And I had a squirrel, and I had to pull out two seed cards, and I pulled out 2 3-pointer cards, but I still won. Yeah.
I will say that I did manage to not only get in the tactical for the most seed, I did manage to match up like one complete set too, because I was going for it the whole time, is trying to block people out of it. So I played both of them or both sides, which is like you said, TC. I'm normally the tactical guy, so I'm just like screw the rest of it. I'm getting tactical points, and it did help a lot. But in the end, I think part of it was also that I was able to get this matching set, which helped as well, which I loved that part too, because you're like watching everybody else and say, don't you take my, I don't even, budgies are in the game, but don't you take my budgie.
Chickadee.
Yeah. Great little game from Matt and Ben. Fantastic.
So I'll say like as a playtester, I was a terrible playtester for this game. Not,
why?
No, because of my feedback at the end. So I made Ben visibly angry at the end of the playtest.
Oh,
and
no.
And it's totally like it's totally cool afterwards. I explained what I actually meant. But don't ever say, I knew I couldn't win, so I was just trying this thing out.
It's
And it was late in the day, and that's totally not what I meant to say, but I said it. And basically, you know how it's like you're taking a tactical, you can either get the seed or you can collect your sets. Well, I was working on collecting the sets. That's all I wanted to do was collect the sets. Didn't care about the seed. And I wanted to see if I could win doing that, right? And that's a good thing to play test for, right? I'm like, okay, I know that my strategy is going to be weird, but I might be able to do that. And that was more the thing, like trying to see how much I could control in a 4-player game. And I didn't win, but I came in second. So I felt like kind of good that I was getting this, because I had so many chickadees. I think I had more than half the chickadees in the deck. So, yeah.
What player count did you play it at?
We played at 4.
4, okay.
And after I was done, I said, now, good feedback-wise, I did explain, you know, it's like with 4 players, it feels a little more family style. And it was more of like, I used the word heuristic, which I can't figure out exactly where I am in the game or what my strategy should be at this point. I'm just trying to tactically
get the most
the good seed and get the most points, right? And so you took that to heart. And I think the issue was, I said right after it, I was like, dude, I want to play this again, but I want to play it like 2-player because I think it would be totally awesome with 2 players.
It was.
I think the 3-player game we played was super sweet.
Yeah, and 3-player might work. If 4-player, it was just a little loose, right? It was like playing, I have the game Parade, and this reminded me a lot of Parade, and it was better because you didn't have, I could see myself playing it with 2 and 3, but the 4 was just a little loose for my taste, right? But I think a lot of people, a lot of the playtesters that came in are going to say, this is great with the 4, too.
It's like how some of the rabbits work, too. Easy Breezy is the same way. Pie Factory is a little loose of 4 players. I mean, there's just going to happen when you have that few amount of cards, when it's a non-traditional, like, I'm going to play a round of hands of cards in my hand, you know?
Yeah, it's tactical. And for me, that type of game, like, always frustrates me, right? Because I just get, it brings out the worst of me. I'm always like, no, I want to see how I can control this. I want to control, right? So I think honestly, if I play it with 2-player again, I will really enjoy it. I think it's awesome the way that you can manipulate how the birds are going to go up to the bird feeder, and even really badly, like kind of screw someone over if you just put a lot of low birds in a row, because they kind of just go up in a line and they have to take like a seed card after a seed card. I really
double whammy there.
Yeah, which can be really bad if you take a crow and then a squirrel, like I think I did at some point. But yeah, I need to play it again with two players, but I think it was really sweet, like the way that the cards worked. So
yeah, it seemed, especially for something called Songbirds, it's one of those where you're just like, you don't expect it to be quite as crazy as it can be, but it's still fun. And also it's fun because at one point in the game, you're going to go squirrel, you know, and that's just going to happen. So
it's a game for Tony and Marty.
Right. Exactly. All right, so Jessica, well, hold on. Here's the point in the podcast where we poke Daryl with a stick. Poke, poke, poke. Is he still there?
Yo.
Oh, there he is. Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Are you enjoying the podcast so far?
This is a great podcast.
That's what I thought. I know. I know. You just keep up with us. We're going to do some fun things. Okay.
Yeah.
Daryl, did you had to have played at least one game at Unpoke.
I did play one game at Unpub.
Ooh, okay. do tell.
What was the one?
I don't know if I can. I'll talk about it later.
Okay, talk about it later.
Okay. I will talk about it with the Dice Hate Me news.
Oh, okay, interesting.
That tells you what it is.
I know exactly what it is, but that's
fine. So I'll wait.
All right, so we'll be back in about 10 minutes to poke you again, just to see if you're still alive. Okay.
Teaser, Daryl is alive.
I'm going to go pee.
Okay, go right ahead.
I will.
I would mute it. I would mute your mic.
Anyone else listening that has to urinate, now would be a good time.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay. All right, Jessica, you played the most games of all of us, so why don't you throw out another one that you played, or even a couple right now for quick, you know, what's up, whatever, if you want to do it quickly.
Okay, so I think I'm going to become the card game girl, because I love these little card games. And I played a bunch at Unpub. And one was by Daniel Solis called Curse You, Robin Hood. And did any of you play this game?
No, after I read the description, I was like, oh, I want to play this now.
Yeah, same with me. But I mean, since Daniel lives local, so I figured I could probably get to the table with him not before too
long. Man, that game makes you say, curse you, Robin Hood, because you can get hosed so easily in this game. But so in this game, you're basically trying to collect loot, you know, goods and stuff, but you don't want to collect the most, because if you have the most, then you're going to catch Robin Hood's eye and he's going to come and steal all your goods and give them to the poor. And so you basically want to collect as much, like the second most, to win the game. And so what happens is you get a hand of cards, and let's see, they're numbered 1 through 10, and there's different goods, like bread 1 through 10, and then ale 1 through 10, that kind of thing. And so you pick a card, you play it face down, and then everybody flips their cards up. And if anybody has a matching number, so if someone has an 8 ale and someone has an 8 bread, then you swap cards, and that goes into your set. And then after that, whoever has the highest card and then whoever has the lowest card, they have to switch, and then that goes into your set. And then if nobody has had to trade cards with anybody, then they can shop it. They can trade cards with something in the market. And there are other goods like, you know, meat and whatever. So you do that through a bunch of rounds until you're out of cards. And then each of the cards has a target on them. Some have one, some have two, and some have three. And then at the end of the game, you add up how many targets you have amongst the different goods, and then if you have the most, then you just flip those cards over and those don't count towards your score. And at one point we played, and one woman, she had the most targets of all the goods, so she had a score of 0. She wasn't even part of the game. But what's cool is that there's also an AI in the game, and they're different characters. So the first game we played with, is it Friar Tuck? In the Robin Hood?
Friar Tuck.
And he is honest all the time. So before we even pick a card to play, he flips his first card and we see what it is, what good it is, and what value it is. And we can try to play and, all you know, kind of pick which cards we're going to play based on what card we see. But there were other AIs too. I played the game twice in a row, because it's a quick, short game. The second game we played with Maid Marian, who is honest part of the time. So she flips her card, and then we pick the cards we play and flip them over. But then since she's sometimes honest, she flips her next card, and if it's the same good, then she swaps cards. So the value of the card might change, and then that might change how the cards are traded and everything. So, and then he has other various AIs that work with the game too. And that game was silly, and it changed. Like, the first game I played, I did decent. I think I came in second or third, and there were one, two, four or five of us playing. I can't remember how many played. And then the second game, I was like, okay, now I know the strategy and kind of how to do it, and I played way worse. But it was so much fun. It was such a good, quick little game. And seriously, like, when you flip the cards over and you realize you have to switch cards with somebody and you get a three-target card on a good that you already have a lot of targets on, you're like, curse you, Robin Hood. And it was silly and fun. Yeah, great, great game.
That sounds cool. Did was there a lot of talking before you would flip your card?
Like, not really. Is there maybe some? Yeah, it's kind of that. You're like giggling and like, oh, I hope, you know, and kind of looking around, trying to see what, you know, look at everyone's faces and stuff. But it was mostly as soon as you flipped your card, you heard a lot of groaning and stuff.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, okay. It was a very, very enjoyable game. Loved it.
Yeah, Daniel's good at coming up with those great little small card games that have a lot of interactivity to them. I mean, obviously, Belle the Ball, and I mean, he's just done so many. He's just really good in that space. And I wish I had a chance to play more of his. I mean, obviously, I've played some of his other ones locally. Most recently, Diorama Rama, which I don't think he got on the table at Umpub, but that was okay.
I don't think he did. Yeah, because he had Koi Pond there too that he was playtesting, which I didn't get a chance to play.
Yeah, he was trying out some different things with Koi Pond. Yeah, he's just so good. He's got an idea in a minute. Did you want to mention another one you played from him, or you want to run with something else?
I actually want to mention Matt Wolf's negotiation game that I actually did play.
Oh, Split the Loot? Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, that's one he's been wanting me to play for a little while now, and I hate that I didn't get a chance to play it, but we'll get a
game
together.
Oh, you would love it.
No, I know.
I would love it.
He's described it to me like, yes, I absolutely want to play that game. And but again, Matt's a local gamer to me, so I can get together with a game day and play it before too long.
So, and I know, I have a feeling you would play just like he played. So, in this game, I can't remember all the details, but basically a group of thieves and there's all this loot, and so you lay out a few loot cards in the middle of the table, and for each round it changes who the ringleader is, and the ringleader is the one who decides how the loot will be split. And so depending on the kind of loot you collect, you end up with different points at the end of the game. Like if you have matching colors, because some of the cards are different colors, or if you had a matching, like if you collected this one statue, like numerous of these statues, you would get, depending on how many you had, you would get points, that kind of thing. So there are different point conditions. I can't remember what they all were. But so you're trying to collect different kinds of cards. And then some cards were just straight cash, which were just worth points at the end of the game. And so when you're the ringleader, people can kind of jockey for what they would like. So there were these little tokens that we had, and we could place them on, oh, I'm looking forward to this card. But somebody else might say, I want this card too. And so the ringleader has to, you know, talk to everybody, or everybody's kind of, you know, trying to give an argument for why I would like this. And then the ringleader's like, well, I'll give you this if I can keep these two, because there was always one more than the number of players. So someone was going to get two of the loot cards. I was more of the, like, the benevolent ringleader. Well, I'll be nice since I know you want this. I'll take this, but I'll take this one instead. And, you know, but I ended up winning because I was a nice leader and Matt was trying to be a little more ruthless and selfish and stuff. But there's also a point in the game where you can collect IOUs if you don't collect loot at all. And there were different conditions. If you had two IOUs, I can't remember what they were, but there was a certain point where if you had three, then you could steal from somebody or something like that. There were just other little things in the game that changed how it could be played and everything. Nobody ever got to that point where it was like a really powerful ability when you had three IOUs. But it was, even though it was a negotiation game and we did have to discuss and stuff, I didn't get too anxious and I did enjoy the game a lot.
Well, that's good. See, look, he made a game that's good for timid negotiators.
Right.
It was nice. Actually really smart and clever. I liked it. It was really good.
It's
I actually
kind
of do want to play it again.
By being nice.
Yeah, if you can design a negotiation game that Jessica likes to play, who knows? So, but you're right. I probably would have played Late Matt, and I can't wait to try it out because it's one of those games that he designed, and he's been wanting me to play it for a while. And man, I wish I had a chance. I wish there were more hours in the day at UmPub.
I know.
It's just not enough.
Honestly, I kind of wish there was like a scheduling thing, because I felt like I spent a lot of time walking around trying to get in on a game, and I was walking around alone by myself, so it was hard to like come up to a table right as a game was about to start where they needed one more player, that kind of thing. So,
well, that's, yeah. Go ahead, TC.
I mean, the problem is like you try to do the schedule. I mean, there's people that do their own kind of scheduling, and you try to do, and that's one of the flip-floppy kind of things about UnPub is like, should there be a schedule for when games are going? And the problem is, if you put the schedule up, it always gets messed up.
I'm like, sure. Things,
like, suddenly you're going 5 minutes over, and then you're kicking people out, and it's like, what's cool about the free-for-all is that there's always something crazy going on. I mean, it kind of sucks if you're, like, just, like, wandering a little bit, but there's, I'm sure as you noticed, there's always a game, so.
Yeah.
Well, and that's a problem that we didn't really have the younger UnPubs, but only because we had smaller groups and you were able to take a break from your game and play somebody else's game and do different things. That's just something we're going to have to come to terms with future UnPubs, which is one of the reasons why I said it would be great to have an extra day, because if I'd had an extra day, I would have been able to play twice as many games as I did, because I had to monitor what was going on with Fate of the Elder Gods and, you know, just check on different things. I would love to have been able to, well, I mean, like with TC and some of the other gamers who went and weren't necessarily listening to the panels, they were able to go and play and test some games, which is very valuable.
Yeah, that was helpful, at least on the Friday night, to have that, because I got a chance to walk around on Friday and then Sunday afternoon. And those were the times where I was walking around. I just kind of, Sunday, I was hating the world for a while, and I just wanted to play other people's games.
Well, you know what? Then, TC, take your turn. Throw out a game you played that you thought was fun.
All right. I will, I'm going to just knock off three off my list so we can keep it going.
Sure.
Right. So, on the Designer Night, I played a game by Corey Heath, which Corey wasn't there, but Dave Chalker was nice enough to
I was going to say, where was Corey?
Yeah, he wasn't around. So, okay. In which I didn't expect him to be there, but I was surprised that there was a Corey Heath game there. I'm like, oh man, I like Zendo, so I want to play this game. And it was called Flying High, and he's had it, I guess, in the wheelhouse, as Dave was saying. He's had it for a while in the wheelhouse. And you can see it. It's very much like I'll do game design nerdery. So it's very much like a Cosmo game from like 2001.
So two player?
Cosmos game. So not two player.
Really?
But like very much a light family game with a cool twist. And so it was hot air balloons that are trying to go, you're trying to fly high. You're trying to be at the highest possible level. So from 1 to 10. And so you have five different.
Oh, I've played this game.
Oh, you have? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's five different hot air balloons, and you're trying to go up higher. And the problem is, if you ever have to go downwards, so if you ever have to play a number that's below where your hot air balloon is on a track, one of the five tracks, then it deflates. And at that point, you're not going to score points at the end of the game for it. So your last move on a track always needs to be upwards in order to score points. And you also kind of want to be higher on it so that you can score more points, right? So it was really cool because you just take the bag at the beginning of the game as a tile game, and you just throw it on the table, and however they come out, you put them into stacks either by color, which is on the back, or by number, which is on the front. So you just don't look at them, and you just put them in their stacks properly. And then you can either choose to flip over a number tile, which will give you a color, and so you move your balloon in that color up to the number that you've chosen, or you can pick a color stack and you flip it over and see what number's on it. So, like, either side of the tile is used. And when you get to the bottom of a stack, you flip over that tile, and it will either hasten the end of the game or cause a wind gust, which will take one row and flip them all over to the other side. So you're like pressing your luck to try to go higher, but you want, sometimes you want the game to end and it just won't end. And you, and then like one of your rows completely gets destroyed, and then you're just hoping that you get the one last tile that you need by the end of the game, so you're going upwards and scoring actual points. And I lost miserably, but I thought I was doing good. It just the game went too long for it. But I enjoyed it. I thought it was very cool, and it's going to be really variable depending on when the game ends. And another one, another quick one that I played was I'm not going to get into the two that I'll compete next time, was Supercell. And this was the Storm Chaser game.
I got to play it.
Oh, you got to play it too.
Yeah.
That was one on my list, and I just didn't get a chance because it was always packed with Dan, and I wanted to play it so bad because I'm such a Storm Chaser junkie. So please tell me about Supercell.
Supercell, just, it's a, right now it's like a hex-based board, and you move around chasing storms and collecting pictures and data on them. And you have to, the key to it is that you want to move in such a way to get the best viewing point of that.
Yeah, the best
storm.
Vantage point, yeah.
Yeah, best vantage point, yeah. And so, depending, I don't know when, because he changed it a lot over the course of the weekend, or at least changed little rules. So, I don't know where you were, Jessica, with it, but we played it Saturday night? Yeah, Saturday, late Saturday night. And it was really neat because you, sometimes a tornado would come out and sometimes it wouldn't. And if you went and observed a tornado, it would give you this bonus tile, which you could use for other things. And then the normal meteorological storm chasing that you were doing was to gain points and set collect, and then also use those points to transmit data on the storms and gain these cards, which gave you extra points at the end of the game. So it was all about getting points, right? But at the same time, you had to figure out how you wanted to move. Movement points all costed time. Transmitting costed time. So you were bouncing over each other, trying to use your time wisely so that you didn't take a super long turn. And then you'd have to sit there and wait until everybody caught up on the time track. So, which was weird. I actually played two games that had time tracks over the weekend.
Me too.
And yeah,
played,
and I
the
played
the same ones.
Yeah. And then I played another one which was not a time track, but it felt very similar to the other game. So yeah, a lot of these games are overlapping. I really like it. But yeah, we gave them some feedback on different ways to score and how to streamline some of the things, and told him that he totally, instead of a die, needed a for the tornado, needed like a top, so you would spin it.
Oh,
so he bought,
oh, that's a good
amazing
idea.
Yeah.
So he bought dreidels. He posted that on online.
That's what that was about, because I was confused about that.
Yeah, he bought dreidels so that there would be a, it's still a 50-50 shot that there's going to be,
yeah,
tornadoes
that, oh,
night.
That's, but, such a good idea.
Yeah, I think it is.
Especially, yeah, when you can put dreidels into a game.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I said. Dreidel, yeah, manufacturing is all of a sudden going to go through the roof.
He kept joking.
Yeah, so that's a few.
Yeah, he kept joking that he wanted the IP for Twister and he was going to be Helen Hunt and stuff.
Exactly.
I would be all over that because I'm like I told him when he was telling me he came to playtest Fate of the Elder Gods with me and Daryl when I was there for spring break, and he was telling me about Supercell, and I'm like eating it up because a long time ago I had a concept for a Storm Chasers board game, and so he was telling me the concept behind that. I'm like, dude, I want to just be in this game.
Yeah. I will. Hey, I will say this. As far as if he's listening, one piece of feedback that after I thought about it for a while was exactly what you're saying. Is I wanted to feel the danger,
right,
of storm changing, chasing, and right now it was sort of like an idea to like get all the points and everything there. But I want a little bit of element of danger in the game, and I don't know how to do that, but you should feel like there's some sort of tension there. Oh, whatever.
Yeah,
it
was. During my playtest, we talked about, like, you know, flying debris, like, damaging your car or something, or, you know, like, trees blocking your path or something like that through a storm or something. I don't know, something to add to it. So I don't know how he's going to implement that. But that time track that he talked about is one, I guess, that they use that in Patchwork. Mm-hmm. And then and also in Thebes, and I haven't played any of those games, and I really like that mechanism of the time, and if you're still in last place, you get to go again, you know, because the last person goes yep. first, it determines turn order. I like that a lot.
Red November has a time track in it, too, that's similar, at least in concept, from what you guys are describing. So, I mean, it's interesting negotiating a time track, but it's also fun. And
yeah,
I can't wait to check out this game. So, Dan... hopefully you're listening, and if you are, whenever you revise it, send me a print and play, and I'll try it out. And add in all kinds of cool stuff. That's like right. Bill Paxton sniffing the dirt.
Oh, that guy's voice.
All right, so Chris, you've
got
one.
I've got one. Let's talk about Legends of Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah, you guys can talk about that while I go to sleep.
Oh.
Come on, you'd like it. It's fun. It's thematic.
Come on over, TC. I'll be the big spoon.
Oh, my gosh.
No, I just didn't get to play it, and I wanted to play it. So I was watching you guys for a while play it.
I totally want you to play it, TC, because you'll have a lot of good feedback for it. But we won't go too much into depth of this, because we'll be talking about Legends of Sleepy Hollow on multiple podcasts from this point forward. But we've talked about it on previous podcasts. It's basically... Ben Pinchback and Matt Riddle's totally thematic, like, just not hack and slash, but you talk about a dungeon crawl. It's more of a story game. It has some legacy in it. It has some upgrade abilities in it. It's really cool, and it's set, of course, after the events of Legends of Sleepy Hollow from Washington Irving. And there are four townsfolk who have banded together to go find out what happened to Ichabod. And it's just so fun because we've introduced so many little elements to the universe. It's a lot of Dutch-based history. We have little gobkins, which are pumpkins that are propelled by animated vines. And we have Shrikroots, which are trees that have come to life. And basically in the first, there's two scenarios that Ben and Matt have put together, and we played both of those, and we made some great strides in playtesting the game. And we have four very different hero types that are going out to try to find the evidence of what's happened to Ichabod. Jessica, you were the Tanner, right?
Was I?
Yes. You were the Tanner. She had a bow.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's right.
So the Tanner that Jessica played was basically very quick, a sort of roguelike character. But she's a Tanner, she's a hunter, she's really good with a bow, she can go forth and be very fast. She's the fastest moving of any of the characters. And then we have the War Vet, which is who I was playing, Matthias Guru. And he has twin flintlocks, and so he goes in kind of blazing. He's sort of the caster character. We have... Elijah Capel, who is the minister, that's who Ben played, and he's kind of the healer, and he also casts blessing spells to kind of cut down on the cursed characters who are in the game. And Mike played with us. Mike Mullins played with us as well, and he was the Undertaker. And the Undertaker's the tank. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's just running in there. He's got a shovel, and he's just like bashing things left and right, and it's a lot of fun. It's taking some of these tropes of these dungeon crawling scenarios, but putting it into a very cool Americana-esque, or at least Americana, not even esque, Americana landscape of right around the edge of the Revolutionary War and whatever happened at the end of Legend of Sleepy Hollow. It was just so much fun. We had a great time playing and seeing how the bad guys would come out, how scenario one would work. Scenario two was a little bit different because it was very much a fight the wave type of thing.
Oh, that was brutal.
It was brutal, but it was very helpful. And not only that, we have a lot of flavor in the game too, in that what you discover sort of has a Time Stories legacy-esque effect on the game. You carry it from game to game, so it's a campaign, and you upgrade your characters and see how those affect the different storylines. And we have a lot of plans for the game itself, but the core, being able to sit down and actually play the game and see how the core played out, was just great. I had a ton of fun. And Jessica, I know you haven't played a ton of games like this, so what did you feel about?
Well, it reminded me of Last Night on Earth a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, and I enjoyed it.
One thing that sets the system apart from some of the other ones is that it's actually an action point system. And as you delve out actions to like your really good skills, they get gummed up and they don't refresh until all the action points.
That was really cool.
Yeah, and sometimes like when you're facing against this horde of, you know, evil things, the fear sets in, and fear actually goes into your action pool and can gum up how long it is until you refresh your actions. So whenever you're able to try to reduce fear or trying to plan out what you're going to do, you think about how many turns you have until you refresh your really, really good stuff. Yeah. So it plays into tactics. It plays into the storyline, especially with the fear that's going around because the townsfolk don't really know what's happening. And all that comes together to make an amazing story, which is what we want. So anyway, that's Legends of Sleepy Hollow. We'll talk more about that. We had two great playtests. Ben, who was there, Matt was not able to attend, but Ben was able to have a couple of really great playtests on Sunday with the system that we had changed a bit from Friday night when we played. And the changes so far are just great.
Well, I really like the idea of being paralyzed by fear. So yeah. At least,
yeah, it was
so, hey,
thematic how they did that.
So even if I hate the game because it's super thematic, I'll at least like that part.
No, you'll like the system. You'll like the fear
system.
Yeah, the system's
interesting.
The action point system.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes you think about that way.
Cool.
What next? Who wants to go next, Jessica? You played a lot. Throw a couple
I did
out.
Play a lot. I played 16 different games.
That's
and
crazy.
I only played one bad one, so that's pretty good. So... one thing I thought was really cool at Unpub was Matt Wolf and his crew that came. The game designers of North Carolina, they had this crew, and they were sprinkled all over the right side of the convention center. And you could tell who they were because they were wearing these blue soccer jerseys with their Game Designer North Carolina emblem and like their name and, you know, number on the back of their thing. It was really cool to see them represent. And I played a few games. Actually, one of my goals is to go around and play a game from all of them, but I didn't get a chance to do that. But I did play a couple, because, you know, I played Daniel Solis' games, but I also played Galaxy Alpha Team Number 1 Go by Mark McGee.
That's the one that everybody wanted me to play, so I'm glad you got a chance to play it.
Yeah, he really wanted you to play it because he knows you don't care for co-ops, but just wanted you to kind of see how it works.
And again, he's a local designer, so we're going to try to get at least in the next month together where we can all play these games, possibly at my place. So we'll see how that goes.
So this game is a space-themed game where we played a three-player, so we each had our own little ships and we're fighting basically the bad guy. You know, it's still a super alpha test, so, you know, he doesn't have all the names and things set up. But so there's the bad guy, and we fight the bad guy, and then when we defeat him, then he upgrades and we fight a bigger bad guy, and then if we beat that one, then he upgrades and we fight the third biggest bad guy, and if you beat the third biggest bad guy, you win. And there's a lot of dice chucking in the game. We have three cards that are our ships. And the first card maybe has the dice values 1 to 2, and then the second one is, you know, 3 to 4, and then the third one is 5 and 6 or something. And they can vary and give you different abilities. And so, for example, if you have a die and you place the 1 die on the 1 to 2, it'll cause 1 damage if you use it against the bad guy. And so you roll these dice, and then depending on if we've damaged some of our portions of our ship, we might only have 2 cards left, you know, as you go along in the game. But it was really cool how also the enemy bad guy, there was this strip of cards numbered 1 through 6, and they're adjacent to each other, and then there was a red circle, like a half circle, in between the cards, so that if you took one, you know, so it made a full circle in between, like, 1 and 2, and between 2 and 3, connecting the cards. But then, if we chuck dice, and then whatever dice values those were, you could pull those cards out of the enemy deck, and so the reds were every time that the bad guy would attack you. So, for example, if you pulled out the 2, 3, and 4 cards because you rolled dice that were 2, 3, and 4, then he only attacks you between phases 1 and 2, and then 4 and 5 and 5 and 6. So, depending on the dice, there's fewer attacks that the enemy can attack against you. And you can take damage to change a die roll to benefit you in terms of when the enemy's going to attack you. It's hard to explain. I'm not the greatest job explaining it. But it was interesting, this mechanism with the battles. I'd never seen anything like that. And then the enemy ship was different cards that were just like our ships, but they were outlined in this shape of the enemy ship. And each column of the ship would attack you each time it attacked. And it was just interesting, just this die check. It was just a different system I'd never seen before. And like I said, it's an alpha test. But it was kind of thematic, too. Like, if one whole section of your ship was destroyed, then you took the card and flipped it over, and it covered like the bottom lowest level of attacks that you could do on your ship, and it kind of upgraded it. And thematically, it makes me think, oh, this part of the ship is damaged, and so, you know, the crew comes over and there's a little bit more crew power to, you know, do more attacks on the ship kind of thing. And it was very cooperative, and one of those games where I didn't feel any kind of alpha gamer in there too, because we were really trying to work together to maximize the abilities of each of our ships to attack the bad guy and everything. So it was fun, and I'm looking forward to seeing how he continues to develop the game.
Now, I really want to play this game, and it was one that was recommended by all of the game designers in North Carolina team. I just only have so many hours in the day, and if we can get together as a local group, it'll be much better. So I'm planning on putting together a game group to play these games that I didn't get a chance to at UmPub later after UmPub, because I have to maximize my time. But I hate that I didn't get a chance to play it. It sounds like a blast.
Yeah, it was really cool. I liked it a lot.
All right, what else you got?
So much.
First of all, though, I think we should poke Daryl and see if he's still alive.
What? Huh?
Huh? Mm-hmm. Oh, he's still there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, cool.
What?
Good, he's still alive. All right, that's good.
It's funny because I'm actually listening to the podcast as if I'm like not on it right now. And so I have my mic muted, and I'm actually doing work for Panda. So it's like, well, I'm just going to be productive and be on a podcast at the same time.
This is great.
Quality. All right, well, so just to mix things up a bit, TC, did you play something else you'd like to mention?
Yeah, let's just go through all the other little ones that I played, and then I'll do the last one so that me and Jessica can talk about it. So I'll go through. I didn't play a lot, so I'll just go through the few that I did and give a brief explanation. So I played Behutensburg, which the only little thing about this is that it came out like on the UmPub program. It's like Czech-o-tensburg, like it just the weird like umlaut didn't show up in some games, so everyone was like trying to figure out how to pronounce this game. So I finally got to play it, and Jeannie actually sat down and showed it to me, and we played two players, and it was really it's very much like a rummy style of game, but it's in a certain order. You have to build your court, so you have to build first the lower level people, like ladies and knights, I can't remember, lords and ladies, and then you had your barons, and then you had your king and queen. And once you got your whole court, you could buy a castle, and then once you had that, you could win. So you kind of had to rummy style put them down, but they could be taken if they weren't protected by like placing more than one, but you had to have a complete court to win. And I think she totally just gave it to me. I think she just at some point was like, I'm not going to play some of these cards that I have just to let you win. So I think she gave the game to me. But that's fine, because she didn't want me to feel bad about losing, right?
Well, so, you liked it 20% more.
So I loved it. No, but I would say, and I gave her some feedback, just a very, very quick feedback, but it was just a really interesting little play test, because it was like 15, 20 minutes, and we were just sitting down there playing alone, like late night on the designer day, which is very cool. Another one I played was, I can't even remember the name of the game, it was like a water garden game that Matt Loomis and Isaac Shalev were working on, and they're still trying to figure out some of the scoring parts, but the idea of the game, and this is totally up my alley, is that it's a abstract game based on making like a water garden, like a Japanese water garden, and it uses the koi in the way that it has that mythology kind of feel, in the sense that a koi is beautiful, so it could it could be a flower, which is one part of the game. You're trying to match up similar types of flowers, or it could be a bird. And so you're matching up the different types of birds that would show up to your water garden. And I think that's what it was, flowers and birds. Yeah, that makes sense. And so that sort of giving a little bit of a tinge of a theme for that story from with the koi fish and the bird that were in love, that Japanese story is interesting. So I really like that. And I like that it was abstract and you just had these scoring elements and you could play the tiles in multiple ways in trying to maximize your scoring potential in the game. And what was cool was that three players felt good. It didn't feel like I was screwing other people over, which is a really tough thing to do in abstract games. So kudos to them for that part. The game still needs a little work. It was a little wonky. I think I won. Yeah, I won. But you know, so
abstract.
I loved it. So I loved it.
Right.
And then I played. I'll do these in the opposite order. I played one card Rocky Road, one card Alley Mode. Nat makes a bunch of different one card games. He has a one card game that's related to Rocky Road, which was by Josh Mills, which I'm going to hold off on because that's what we're going to talk about. So this was Ice Cream, and you're just moving along a time track very simply, and you can upgrade your token by flipping it over to the other side. It's supposed to be a quick game, plays in a few minutes, and two-player head-to-head version of this Rocky Road game. And it moves along a time track and uses dice to simulate fulfilling orders. Hmm. Interesting, but it definitely needs some one other rule to try to... We were having some issues. So it definitely needs like one or two other rules to get it so that it's a game more than what I felt like right now. I was kind of like I was moving around, but I didn't know exactly what my strategy was. But it is a one-card game, and so you got a lot of... We got a room to move. So that was kind of interesting. And then I think my favorite game at Unpub that I played, even though honestly I'm listing like seven games, I didn't play very many games. My favorite game, though pretty much a tie with Rocky Road, was Darwinauts.
I wanted to play that game.
Yeah, this was Chris Bryan's.
I wanted to play that too.
And it was originally Galapagos exploration themed, which makes sense.
That was the one that Daryl loved last year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I played it at Gen Con last year, and I really liked it.
Yeah, it's really solid.
I was trying to get Chris to play it, but just times never lined up.
Well, he's good now, because I know what that's coming out with Renegade, right?
No, it's not Renegade?
No, it's...
Action Phase. Yeah, there we go.
Action Phase, right.
Yeah, so the people who did Kadama and the...
That's not Renegade. The reason why it's so good, though. The reason why it's going to get a lot of attention is because Action Phase got Vincent Dutrait to do all the art.
Nice.
Yeah, that's what he was saying. He was like,
that game is going to look amazing.
He said he was super stoked about that.
Yeah.
However, the game itself is sweet. It's a tile laying game. You get a hand of two tiles, and as opposed to, say, a Carcassonne or something like that, you'd use the Carcassonne style, place a dude, and then remove them later, but you get to choose. So on your turn, you get two actions, and you get to place a tile, or you can place a dude, or you could place a dude and then place another dude, or you could, once you're out of tiles, you could refresh your hand, but the only way to do that is take all your dudes off the board and collect resources for where they are. So the game is very, again, just like Rocky Road, they had a lot of similarities in the way that the gameplay is. But these are super tight power fillers, I guess, in the sense that you play for like 30 minutes. And that's how long the game is. And it's tiling, it's got some worker placement in it, and it's very tight scoring because of that. So no one's going to run away with the game. And it's just a really satisfying experience to try figure out timing. I think that's the biggest thing about Darwinauts that will surprise you is the fact that you start playing, you're like, oh, okay, lay a tile or do this, whatever. And then you realize after three turns have gone, oh man, if that person does that, then I'm going to have to do this, then this, and if they could do that, and then that, and then if they, yeah. So all of a sudden the options explode and you have to be really aware of what other people are doing, which is great. So really good implementation of player interaction there without it feeling mean. Cool. And so very cool. And the final one is Rocky Road, and that's with Josh Mills, another one of the North Carolina buddies.
Yep.
And this is the reason I said it was similar to Darwinauts is because they both have tight endgame scoring. You get a few, like you may have three or four goals that you collect, and you get some sort of bonus for set collection along with the goals that you're trying to do. And so the game is about getting ice cream. You're an ice cream man, and you're selling ice cream to people. And so you have these cards that you pick up that are ice cream orders, and you have your truck in front of you. And when you have a card, you can place it in front of your truck to fulfill certain types of ice cream that the kids in that neighborhood want. And you can use the cards in your hand to play a certain type of ice cream. So every card has ice cream on it, and every card has some sort of amount of ice cream that needs to be fulfilled in two steps. So like I take a turn to fulfill this ice cream, and then I serve these two kids. And then once you've done that, the cool thing is that you take the card that you fulfilled and you put it at the end of your truck, and it counts as either victory points or it might build an engine so that now, oh man, now I already have a popsicle in my truck. I don't have to use a popsicle for my hand mm-hmm. in order to do this, or a push-up pop. Yeah, sorry. I'm not doing it very thematically, but ice cream and push-up pop and everything. So what did you feel about Rocky Road?
I really liked it a lot. Again, it used that time track, which I really love. I think it's fun. You can kind of manipulate things by trying to still be the last player and everything. I did terrible in the game, but I still enjoyed myself. It was just really thematic, and I love the cards, too, how you slid it underneath your truck as you fulfilled the orders, and then it was multi-use, then you rotated it to show if, you know, if he had victory points or if he had a permanent, you know, orange push pop to use, you know, for future, you know, customer need fulfillment. So it was a quick little game and very fun and light, and I liked it a lot.
Yep, I think it scratches that itch for someone that's just trying to play like a very quick game that has some strategy. And you have to do you have to plan out what you want to do as far as, do I want to draw a bunch of cards right now, or do I want to, which will take some time so that mm-hmm. I have a lot of options, or do I want to just start working on my engine now and go for like a low, like some really easy orders to do, and I'll fill this really easy order out, and then I'll get a push-up pop that I can use for the next order. I don't get any points, but I get like push-up pop, which right. is sweet.
And you got to pay attention to what people are doing around you, because one guy just stole the game out from under us because we weren't paying attention to what he did, because he got lucky with the cards he drew, and he had this really quick engine with these the teal colored popsicles, and then right away, because he had like permanent popsicles, then he was able to fulfill like this next card he had really quick, and then get one of the big cards, like he won a beach card or something like that that were worth extra points and everything. And what was cool around the time track, too, was around the time track, there were a couple of wilds. There were the little blue, red, white, and blue rocket pops.
Yep.
And if you were the first to land on that spot, then you grab the wild. You can use it as any kind of ice cream for future use, which was cool, too. And yeah, that was my second favorite game of the convention.
Yeah, I think I didn't get any of the pops, and that's why I lost. But I did pretty good. I just, it's like you don't have enough time to do. I always like to just build the engine. So yeah. I had a popsicle of every flavor or every type of ice cream that you sell, but I couldn't win because I just ran out of time. There wasn't mm-hmm. enough time to score points.
Yeah.
So I liked, we gave him feedback that I like the rocket pops, but I would like some reason to maybe not be the first one to go to something, or just maybe randomizing those little tokens so that you have some cool little abilities that are different each game.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
So, but that was it. And so, another one. Like I said, the only reason I say it's like Darwinauts is because they both had these scoring conditions at the end where you had to get a certain recipe and score the card, and then it was just you only scored like maybe four or five cards. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah, this was one that Josh had shown to me. I guess last year at some point, because I was looking at Milkman, which Josh had.
I still like Milkman better, though.
Milkman.
I think I did too, actually.
Milkman's fantastic, and you know, it's one that I've kind of had in the hopper. I'd hoping to do with Dice Hate Me Games eventually, and thankfully Josh has been very patient with that. And but he had this. He's like, well, it's still kind of dairy and milk based. Is like, do you want this game? And I'm like, well, I don't know that I want to have a whole like pantheon of dairy based products for Dice Hate Me Games, even though it's great. But he was like, he was talking to Jason about it, Jason Katarski, and
yep,
he said, do you mind if I talk to Jason about this? I'm like, no, of course not. You know, like this fits perfectly with what Jason's doing with Green Couch Games. And so we all kind of had, or at least Jason and I had a kind of a powwow. And I said, like, please, you know, if you can do something this, take it, because it's fun, it's cool, and it's going to be a Green Couch game, which is perfect for this type of game. And that's kind of, I mean, just as an aside, this is where we operate with things that are happening in unpub and unpublished games. Is like, we want to see these games published. We don't necessarily always see them as competition. Yes, there are a couple of companies that'll put something out where we see that, like, this is going to be competition. We want to beat someone to market. No, it's not like this at all. Like Rocky Road, A La Mode, and a few other things, but particularly this game is like, I just want to see it in print because Josh makes fun games, and so does Jason. And so it just worked out in such a way. And I'm so glad that you were able to play it and give feedback to make it even an even better game when they release it on Kickstarter and do it, which is going to be awesome. So let's move on to something else. I'm going to mention something really quickly. And I'm going to do two in a row. One is Laser Riders. And I don't know if anybody else got a chance to play this game.
No, I wanted to try it because I like Tron.
Dude. TC, you will love this game. I mean, it's just completely off its hinges. It's so fun. And basically what it is this is something that, this is from Cardboard Fortress, Anthony and Nicole, who had been developing this for a while. And Anthony, before Unpub, just said, you know, I tested this the last Unpub. It didn't really work. It was too complex. He's like, he stripped it down. He made it simple. And basically what it is you're a light cycle. You're in Tron. And you're trying to race around gathering these goals, and depending on what your gear set is, how fast you're going will depend on what the actual, I guess, turn sets that you have. Like, you know, if you're going slow, you have a lot of different turns you can depend on. If you're going fast, you're just basically blazing across the board and trying to get to the goal as fast as possible. And you're just hoping that you're on track. What's amazing about this game is it's You're just trying to, I mean, a little bit of it is like the X-Wing turn mechanic. You know, you're looking at how your turns might work and what gear you're in. And if you're like up in sixth gear, you're just going to be like blazing across the thing. And if you want to step down, you have to make sure you roll a certain number and don't wreck or mess yourself up. And you can run into other people's lines, just like in Tron Light Cycles. And on the table, it's amazing. You can see all these different light beams going around and making these weird turns and trying to turn back on themselves and breaking each other's lines. And it's just a ton of fun. And it's not overly complex. It's mostly like trying to maximize your chances of getting the goal that you need. And I only played about half a game. I was actually helping Stephanie while she was playing, and I watched what everybody else was doing. And even that much of me playing was enough for me to say, like, you guys have something here. This is cool. We want to take a look at this at PAX East. And it was just one of those games that has such great table presence, but also very easy to play, but also challenging because you got to, you know, maximize your angles and try to figure out if you're going to do the right thing and curve back on yourself and try to get these goals that are sitting on the table, because every single game is going to be a little bit different. And I had a blast. So hopefully you will all get a chance to play this as they continue to progress and develop the game.
Sounds cool.
I think you'll like it.
I will.
And I will also mention that I had a chance to play Rubble Rousers from Adam McIver.
Again?
Again.
Jeez.
I'm always testing the progression of this game. That was something that last time I think we talked about Rebel Rousers was the coverage from BGGCon, and just such a fun game. And now, you know, Adam's taken it to such a way that it's a very square board. There's variable play. There's a much more streamlined play. And go back and listen to some previous podcasts, but this is a dexterity game with dice where you're taking trucks or dice that represent trucks and you're flicking them all on the board. Either you're taking demolition contracts or construction contracts, depending on the, I think, five or six different construction materials in the game. And we even made some great headway when we play tested it at UmPub and saying, like, well, I think that, you know, this needs to be accounted for so that somebody doesn't play the skirt strategy. In other words, they just like lightly flick the dice onto the board. It will depend on the number of players in the game, but again, this game has progressed so much from the initial showing that Adam's shown me in the game, and I was able to play with Adam and Carrie, and I love this game. It's so much fun, and honestly, I really hope we're able to do it as a Dice Hate Me game / Fabled Nexus type of game. It's fantastic. So listen for more about that.
Sweet.
What else we got? All right,
you gotta finish off your list. So Jessica, you finish off your list. So do the little ones.
I'll do not a little one, but I'll just simply mention Fate of the Elder Gods. You've heard us mentioned our playtests on several different podcasts at this point. You'll definitely be hearing more about this because we'll get King Richard on here. Daryl, you still with us?
Yep.
There he is. So we had a lot of great playtests of Fate of the Elder Gods at UmPub. We had a lot of great player, or at least playtests before UmPub, but being able to present the game to unfettered players, people who aren't familiar with it necessarily, we got a lot of really cool feedbacks about like what should be fixed. We sat down on Sunday night and went over with Richard about what we need to fix as far as like, you know, the Elder Gods themselves, some curses, some things like that. I'm not going to mention much more about this because, to be honest, you're probably going to be hearing more about it than you probably ever wanted to, because this game is amazing.
And it looks fantastic. Well, I mean, the pieces and stuff and the new cards that I saw that I hadn't seen last time, it's looking really, really good.
Yeah, and that's a big red flag.
For your wallet.
And what's fun about all the stuff that we did for feedback for UmPub is that we're gathering together at the 1st of May. We Daryl's flying down here, and we're going to drive down to Richard's place. And we're going to play test the game for about three days straight, get everything done, ratchet everything down to the T's, and then progress forward from that. There's a couple other things that I want to mention, but one I'll save for the very end because we want to get into it just a little bit. But I there's two games that I played with Jessica, or not with Jessica, but one I did play with Jessica, one that Jessica played independent of me, and I'd like for her to talk about it, is Match Quilt from Lauren Woolsey.
Oh, goodness.
Can you talk about that?
Well, it's basically kind of a puzzle game. There were these different cards that were different quilt patterns, and they all have names. So I can't remember what some of the names
like
of the patterns were.
Birds in the air.
Yeah.
That's the one I can initially remember because I'm not a quilter.
But yeah, unique things like that.
Yeah.
And so you draw cards and you're building this pattern. So you have to build a grid, you know, building your quilt. And what was the, how big was it? I can't remember how big it was.
4x4?
Yeah, 16.
16, yeah.
16 cards. And so you do it one bit at a time. So you can, if you build one in your left corner, you can build up, or you can start a new row and then you can build up in the rows. And you got points for building, and they all had different colors. So you got points if you matched two of the three colors on adjacent cards. And then you got points for some of the patterns were on the quilt patch were 5x5 or 4x4 or 3x3 kind of thing. And so you got points if in the same row or column you also had patterns that were of the same, you know, size pattern. And so you're being puzzly that way and then drawing new cards from the middle to add your hand to play. And I learned that I'm just bad at puzzles. I played with this with Paul Owen. and one other player, and he was really good building up this big pattern and earning all these points, and I was just terrible, didn't know what to do. And it's very solitaire like, you know, and so there can be a little bit of downtime as you're waiting for the next person to go and grab their card. But it was interesting how it played out. And then you also got points if you got, so you have a grid of, you end up with a quilt of 16, but if you had all 12 of the different kinds of patterns, I think you also got points at the end of the game too. And that's one thing it took me a while to figure out, because I was not paying attention to the names of the cards at all. So, because we just played a base game, and on the tops of the cards were other information to where if you played more advanced games, there were different abilities and different things you could do during the game too, which she explained to us later. But it was very interesting, but I was just bad at it, and it's just a little, it, my alpha gamer came out a little bit. Well, it didn't. I just didn't let it. I just started putting cards out because I didn't want to hold everybody up, because I was going to try to think too hard about how I could maximize my points. But I would probably play it again to see if I could do better.
What was amazing about playing Match Quilt, though, was the fact that we played like the full gamery game. Like, there's ones you can just play matching patterns. Mm-hmm. You can also play with the top of the card, which is uber gamer level. So you have to think about, like, okay, I'm going to maximize this. This is in play now. I can try to build my points up and so on and so forth. So there's two different modes of the game. One is very casual. One is very, like, very crunchy, gamery type of puzzle. And I love the fact there's two different sets to the game itself. And the one thing that I noticed is, like, the entire time we were playing, like, people would come by, just casual gamers that were checking out what was going on at the tables, and they go, like, whoa, quilt patterns. Like, I quilt, or my mom quilts, or my grandmother quilts, and, like, I recognize those patterns. Like, that's amazing. And that's what really kind of struck me about the game, was it appealed to so many different gamers who came around, whether they were casual or hardcore gamers. And I didn't really understand that that would happen, but it was amazing. And so that was kind of fun to see from a publishing standpoint, how that type of game really developed itself or showed itself on the table, which I think is one of those things that you have to take into account when you evaluate a game from a publishing standpoint of how you play it. And that happened a lot during the game.
And to me, it was interesting because the game is so smart. And she is like a PhD candidate in astronomy or something. And it kind of came through because she's just so smart. And it came through in her game design too.
Yeah, she's an astronomy, yes, but I think astrophysicist might be even what she's doing now. She's defending her thesis before PAX East, which is in like 3 days, at least in relation to this podcast. And she's going to be there testing out Match Quilt in the Unpub area at PAX East. And, I mean, she's whip smart. She's fun. She definitely gets the theme of what she's trying to develop, and this game was just so refreshing to be able to play a game like this, that not only did we have a good time as gamers, but everybody coming by going like, wow, what is that game? I want to play that game, you know. All right, so that's it for Match Quilt. I'm going to save my last game, which was what Jessica and I played finally on Sunday night. But TC, anything else you want to mention?
Well, no, I'm done. That's what I'm saying. Go, because I am out. I am totally out.
All right. Well, Jessica, before we get to our final game that we played, is there anything absolutely you want to mention that you played?
I'll just mention the other couple ones I played. Matt Wolf's Tsunami at Yeti Beach, where the Yeti from the mountain in Avalanche at Yeti Mountain, right? So he's all mad that all these people came to his mountain, so he decided to retire at the beach. And now there's like the tsunami coming, so you start out surfing in the waves and you're trying to move onto the beach and then into the hills. But there was just a silly theme. It was really cute, and I liked that game a lot too. And then
That'll be about Green Couch Games, right?
I don't know.
I'm assuming it will be, yeah.
And then I did get a play of Dan Kassar's The Blood of an Englishman, which is the Jack and the Beanstalk and Giant game that won the Cardboard Edison Award
Right.
Is that right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that game gave me anxiety. I played as the giant, and he was Jack. And I wish I had played it again and tried it as Jack, because I played two-player against Dan. And it gave me a lot of anxiety. The giant only gets to do one move, and I was like, why can't he do two and stuff? And stressful, but very – that was a smart, clever game too. And, yeah, I think that's it.
All right, so that brings us to Sunday night, where Jessica, myself, and TC got to play.
And, yeah.
Yep. No, Daryl was busy
doing Ruth. Something. Ruth was there.
Ruth played with us. And we got to play a special Richard Lanius joint, which is called Marvel Knights, a disc flip game, which is one he's wanting to pitch to Upper Deck, so he's able to use the Marvel Knights license. In other words, all the what I call the street level heroes for Marvel, a Daredevil, a Punisher, Elektra, Luke Cage. It was just,
Bullseye.
What's that?
Bullseye.
Bullseye. Oh, yes. Yeah. We had Bullseye in the game as well. I mean, all of these very Daredevil-centric type of universe, Marvel Universe characters. And the core of the system is a disc flip system. So anybody who if you have not played a Richard Lanius prototype, you're missing out, because
goodness.
He goes,
how's that called a prototype?
I know, it's like a full-fledged game. Whenever he makes something, he goes whole hog. He's got not only lamination systems, but he does Mod Podge stuff to protect the discs and the things that you're using, especially throughout the game. And basically what you're trying to do is each individual of your characters, no matter who you're playing, has goals throughout the game. Like, for instance, I was playing the Punisher, and I could get points if I took out corrupt cops in the city. And the city basically is represented by a 3x3 grid, so it's 9 different locations, including streets that are between those locations. The different locations have abilities. You have an ability. You can do different things. You have two sides to your flip disc, and when you flip those, either it's going to be a base ability that builds on itself, so you're able to flip it and get like 3 different abilities throughout an entire round. You get like the maximum, like for instance TC with Luke Cage, if you got 3 of them face up, he's completely indestructible, nobody can touch him whatsoever.
Which never happened, but I got 2 at least.
Yo, you got 2, which was more than enough. I mean, Luke was just crazy powerful.
Well, and, you know, Bullseye shouldn't get in the way of Luke Cage. Not really a fair matchup.
It's true. And again, this is what we call an alpha playtest. This is Richard had played this a little bit with Steve Avery. He had done some preliminary testing, but this is really the full-on playtest that we got to test out. And just setting up the game, like, got my juices flowing. I was like, the theme, especially from the Marvel stuff, I was like, I want to play this so bad. Let's just play, you know? And even playing through the game, you got to see how the different characters and the heroes and the villains, and in my case, I was the Punisher, so I was stuck between 2 of them. It's like it plays completely true to the characters. It's really a testament to Richard understanding the thematics of what he's building, which is what he's good at. But for the Marvel Street level or Marvel Knights types of heroes, it was so much fun. Every flip you made of the disc, basically you flip the disc and it has to at least go end over end once, and then it lands on the board. And either if you land halfway on a location and halfway into the streets, you decide whether you want to be in the streets or in the location. If you go to location, you get to enact certain abilities there. You get to enact abilities that happen on your disc. You get to possibly check out a mystery that's at that location, which introduces all kinds of different variable play things. I just had an absolute blast playing this game. And what the amazing thing, and I'll let TC talk for a second, but the amazing thing that I saw for this game is that if you can introduce a game that excites TC that's this fully thematic, you got a winner. And like, he was all in.
I mean, yeah, this game was like I said, my favorite game from Unpub. This was my post Unpub, so I could clarify it and say this was my favorite game of the weekend. No, this is huge. No, I mean, this is just most Most times. All right. So when Richard Lanius has a game out, I don't necessarily perk up like everybody else does. I know that's sacrilege, but at the same time, he doesn't necessarily make games that are in my playstyle. And especially I've seen his other prototypes too. They're just, they have a lot of theme and everything, but like they usually like throwback style. This one was just way overboard. Like you were immediately
thrown into a comic book.
Yeah, it was a finished product. It looked like a finished product, right? So, well, with the exception of some things, right? And that was weird to see because it was just it's straightforward like that detailed. But it's not just that. It was the fact that like this game was in an alpha state and it played so well. Like I don't know if it was him and Steve Avery working on this together or what, but him and Steve Avery just thought of everything. So when I played, I didn't have to go, okay, well, how does this thing work? It just worked. And then every single turn I did something, I got to do something. There was like very few times. And the only times when you didn't get to do something was when it was like, you just completely missed the board.
Yeah.
Or you landed in the road and there was just happened to be nothing possible to do in that spot where you landed because you're terrible at flipping, right? but there was just so rarely did that happen. And even when it did happen, you were like, oh, it's totally my fault. I should have gone for this instead because that was just way too far away. So I don't know. The only thing I can say is that it just needed to be a little quicker, and that was just because we were playing with five people and we didn't have some way to track whose turn it was next. So a lot of it was like, okay, so now someone from the villain side, now Punisher, now someone from the other side, now the villain, right? And it was just, I couldn't keep track of that. But as far as the rest of the game goes, man, just crazy. Really good. Just so, a really cool system. No matter what you got, you felt good. So, I don't know. Felt like a superhero playing a coin flipping game, and that's crazy.
Well, I mean, also, It plays a little bit into, I mean, TC, you're not, a stranger to the coin flipping system. I mean, you got the Danger coin from Rock Babies, which was, honestly, in the timeline of things we've talked about, was forever ago, which is probably 4 years ago, but it's still a solid system. And to see a variant, or not necessarily a variant, I mean, it's just like a similar kind of thing, but played in a different way for superheroes. And to do it, I mean, like the old POG system, I mean, to do it in such a way that makes you excited with every flip you make, that's huge.
Yeah, as he was explaining it, I was like, okay, I know what's going on. And it wasn't just that, it was when we flipped over the mysteries and they affected the game in such a good way. Like, it made it actually, like, you would get to unlock the mystery, and you wanted to. You never want to just go, oh, this is a mystery. No, it was like, sometimes it was a truck hijacking, truck comes out on the board, now everyone's trying to get to that truck to get some points, but I'm killing Bullseye every turn because of it. there was no player elimination. If you died or got knocked out, you just came back the next turn, and you got back up again, and fought again. But you could gang up on people and try to get the points, but if you missed, I mean, it could be far away for you to shoot if you're on the other side. So all those things worked really well, and the game is just fast and good, and he already had scenarios that you could play, and the scenarios were really just straightforward. I don't understand if Upper Deck was like not going to pick this up. I just don't understand why they wouldn't.
I agree.
Like, they'd have to be insane. Yeah. Although Upper Deck is terrible with their rule books, but other than that, they can get over that part. They'll do a great job.
I would agree with that. And honestly, like, I mean, I'm torn because obviously, to be honest, I'd like to take this and adapt it to the Sentinels multiverse. I would love to, for our game or for our company. But at the same time, I had a absolute blast playing the Punisher and seeing Daredevil doing stuff and Elektra doing things. And it's just like, it was so fun to be able to see that universe come to life. And for someone who has that library or that license of library to be able
my favorite moment was that I'm searching around for all the innocent bystanders just because I was looking for Jessica Jones, because I knew that if I'm Luke Cage, I can find Jessica Jones. I'll get her. I'll get 2 points. Great. And it's like, but the thing was, someone else found her. And they're like, oh, Jessica Jones. And they're like, oh, look, there's a star on that. I wonder what that does. Let's read the card. Oh, Jessica Jones beats you up.
Yeah, it was awesome. It escapes. Yeah.
That was me as Elektra, because Elektra got points for capturing civilians. And so I captured the civilian, but I flip it over and it says it's Jessica Jones and she beats me as she escapes. I'm like, dang it! So I had so much damage early on in the game. It was so irritating.
I loved it, because I was like, I'm looking all around for Jessica Jones, and then you find her first and just get beat you up and then leaves.
Okay.
I don't really need to save her. I don't know why I'm
really
doing
so
this.
Thematically appropriate and so fantastic. I mean, again, that's the type of thing that happens with a Richard Launius prototype, is that you get into it, and especially when it comes to a finished game, you feel the thematics behind it. It's what's been so great working with him on Fate of the Elder Gods, and what's been so great just about him in general. Like, he just literally loves the story, and it shows through in his game designs, and this one is one of the best that I've ever seen.
It showed playing with him, too. He turned into a little kid. He was so excited.
Oh, absolutely he does. That's why I love playing with Richard. No matter what you play with Richard, he gets into the game. Like, my first time ever playing Defenders of the Realm was at Origins 2011, and I got to sit down and play the game with Richard. And he was a little kid the entire game. And it was like, it made the game to me. And he just does that no matter what. He's got that joy of playing the game and getting into the characters and the thematics and the story. And that's what's so fun. And I'm so glad that his personality was shining through in this particular prototype, because when he described it to me, I was super excited. But after we started playing, I was even more stoked. I was like, I want to keep playing this all night. And I wish we could.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. So there we go. I think we've come to the end of Unpub. We'll run through some Kickstarters and then go to the end of the podcast, and we're going to do that now. All right, so we're back. Whether Jessica has cut us or not, and we have to divide these into like 3 or 4 Kickstarters, it doesn't really matter. But I have 3 that I'd like to mention. Do any of you have any of the Kickstarters you want to mention before I go into it?
No.
I'd like to mention one.
Well, yes, Daryl. We'll mention the one you want to mention.
No, there's another one.
Oh, there's another one. Oh, please go first.
Yeah, I added
you're still
it to
alive.
The list.
You're still alive.
Oh, I added to the show notes.
Oh, sure. I see it. I see it now.
Okay. There it is. It's right there.
Oh, there
it's
it is.
It's the longest title. No, it doesn't. The other one does, but it's close. So this is one by Garrett Herder that I played back a while ago, and I played the prototype. I actually played it and showed you with it at BGGCon last year. Mm-hmm. And at that point, it was a game called Delirium.
Right.
And it was I don't know who I am, but I know who everyone else is, so I'm trying to ascertain information to realize who I am. Like, I have a short-term amnesia kind of thing. And Luke Petersmith, Fund 11, picked it up, and they rethemed it to the Miskatonic School for Boys. And it's kept that exact same game build. Obviously, the components and the build look far, far nicer and a little more engaging than the face down card kind of thing. And yeah, so now it's running like that. And now the amnesia kind of makes a little bit more sense, because now you know that, you know, the elder gods may or may not be behind everything that's going on. So yeah, Miskatonic School for Boys. I highly recommend you check it out. It was a lot of fun when it was Delirium. And it's a Lovecraft theme, so it's already got me on it.
All right. Well, there you go. So, yeah, I mean, it was interesting because I didn't know that this was Delirium, but when you mentioned it to me and they said it was Delirium, I'm like, this is a good game. We had a good time playing this game. And I obviously, I love the Lovecraft or Cthulhu Mythos theme, which definitely should go check it out if you like that kind of thing. But also, just the social aspect of playing this game is actually a lot of fun.
Am I stupid? Am I stupid, guys?
Who? You?
No. No, remember in the game, like, Vassal
was
like,
am
I stupid? Am I stupid? Because he's trying to figure out his trait.
Right, you have a lot of different traits in the game, so you're asking really ridiculous questions of each other, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Not just
And there's always someone that's going to be lying.
Of course.
That person has to be careful how they lie, because he doesn't want to alert everyone else that he's been lying, so.
Right.
Yep.
All right, so I'll go quickly through mine. We have one called Scuttle, which is by Peter C. Hayward, which is a friend of ours at Greater Than Games, and it is a pirate card game for all ages. It already has $42,000 on, I know, exactly, 1,820 backers, equaling $42,828 on Kickstarter. It was far and beyond what he expected, but I mean, the art in this is adorable. The concept of the game is adorable. You can get the base game for $9, but you can also get the base game plus the different expansions for $14, which is a no-brainer on Kickstarter. I mean, let's be honest. But the art really makes it shine. It's a game that comes in a small footprint, but you can kind of play in multiple different ways. And it's a very simple play. It's either draw a card or play a card. But you're kind of playing until you get 21 doubloons. It's a variant on some of the other card games that involve 54 cards. I would definitely recommend checking this out on Kickstarter because it has resonated so greatly with so many people. We've got some good reviews from, let's see, like Beard Meeple has done that. I've watched one of those reviews. It also talks about the expansions that you can go into. You'll fall in love with the art. So go check it out. This is Scuttle. I also want to mention Shenanigans, the musical. Does anybody know about Shenanigans, the musical?
No.
So you basically are in the game. Your role is you're members of an orchestra in crisis. You basically go in and say, like, what's going on? Someone can't play an instrument, and you're sabotaging the production, and you want to find out who the culprit is. And it's so weird. It's really a weird topic or theme for the game itself, but it's a social game for 4 to 10 players. And you want to try to find out if you're the manager, you want to kick out the artist that is sabotaging the orchestra. The artist wants to try to act like a renegade, like in Bang or something like that, and get anybody else to be kicked out. And everybody else has their own individual goals. So it's a little bit, I mean, yes, it has some ties to Werewolf and things like that. But it's kind of fun because it's based with this really quirky art, this theme that is very different from all the other social games that came before it. And it just seems fun. It seems like, honestly, if Tiffany Bonson, you're listening, you're going to want to back this because she teaches orchestra. So... Anyway, a lot of fun.
Or maybe it will be hit too close to home.
Oh, possibly. She might like.
She'll be really sad when she sees it.
Too much like work. But go and check it out. The art's cute. The thematics of the game is actually cute, and it just seems like something that people want to check out. The other thing that I mentioned is the Lark Lamp, which is a magic lantern game system. This is something that relates to. What's it called, TC? Waldschattenspiel. It's a light game. So the Lark Lamp is actually a game system.
Oh, I know what you're saying. Okay, yeah. I know. The basically the game where there's a candle in the middle.
Right.
And you're just trying to stay away from whoever, like you're trying to hide from the person that's controlling the people of the light.
And it depends on what the inserts are for the magic lamp system, because you can slide these different cards into the system, and it projects the board onto the table. So probably you'll have to play in lower light situations and so on and so forth, but it's kind of cool because it makes a board around this lamp depending on how you want to play it. Oh, it's so cool. It's not exactly like Waldschattenspiel. in that you want to hide, but the different games, there are different systems that come with the actual the Magic Lantern system, that you're going to either be playing an abstract game that's created by the inserts that's put on there, or you're playing something that's similar to Wall, Shot, and Spiel, where you have to like avoid these bug type things. And it's really interesting. It's very different than what I've seen on Kickstarter. Right now, it's at $11,000 of their $3,000 goal, which blows me away, by the way, to do this type of system for only $3,000. I'm like, you're kind of crazy.
I don't know, though. I mean, it's cutout cards and a lamp in the middle. I mean, I guess basically that lamp is going to be expensive, so I don't know. Yeah, this is really, yeah,
it looks like you just put it together.
This is a really good pick. This is a good crazy game.
I agree. I mean, I don't know how it'll play, but I love the concept behind it, and that's really why I wanted to highlight it for our Kickstarter update for the end of the podcast.
Very cool.
So there's one other thing. Daryl, hey, you've been asleep for most of the podcast. Can you tell us about a very, very significant Kickstarter campaign going on right now?
Yeah. So I've got a Kickstarter campaign going on with you and Mike Mullins and everyone at Good In Games for a game called Bottom of the Ninth Clubhouse Expansion.
Yay!
Yay!
Okay.
So, yeah, Bottom of the Ninth Clubhouse Expansion is a big box expansion for Bottom of the Ninth. And it's going to include a box that you can fit every single card that's ever been made, this expansion, and future expansions, a lot of future expansions. The box will actually hold up to, I think it's about 225 cards.
So about 80 expansions at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, three more.
If we hit everything we want, I believe the box will be a little less than half full with this campaign. So it also includes a new thing called equipment. And equipment are little mini Euro cards, and your team starts with a budget, and you can spend that to equip your players with gear, with tools, or with just clubhouse improvements, which means overall team upgrades. And they allow additional stats onto the players, as well as to tweak current stats that are on the players. So it kind of adds more replayability for all your favorite players. So you can find combos not only within how they're in the lineup, but now you can also build combos with the equipment or the tools and stuff that you equip onto them. So it's a really, really, really good. Like, I'm really proud of it. And this one is Mike's brainchild. I'll totally give him credit on this because the equipment is just a really smart idea. And the whole thing came about was, well, we could put more players, but then we come up with new abilities, but then no one's going to want to play with the old players because these new abilities may end up being better overall.
Well, let me ask you this, Daryl.
Yeah.
Just by begging the question,
mm-hmm.
do the equipment really work as well with the old players as they do the new ones?
Yes.
Really?
Totally.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
That's the whole point of it is, so like there's a new shift mechanic that allows more wiggle room with natural rolls. So previously, there's a lot of abilities that key off of natural rolls only. And a natural roll is you roll the die and you don't touch it. You don't modify it or re-roll. Whatever that is, that's a natural roll. And so a lot of things like with traits or MVPs mainly were kind of getting ignored because you had a 1-in-6 shot of rolling it and that was that. So we came up with this new ability called a shift. And so say if it's a shift 3 up, so it's a little, it looks like a natural roll, but the top half is an arrow. And it'll still have the like the number of a natural roll, so it'll be like a 3 with an up arrow. So when you see that, you're like, hey, I can shift a 3 up. Okay, so if I roll, hey, look, it's a natural 3, I can shift that to a 4, because I can go up once, and it's now counts as a natural 4. So it's a fun little way to mitigate natural die roll and still keep them natural. So it kind of gives comboing wiggle room, like I said. So
right, and that's something that happens not only in new players, but equipment.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah.
What else? Is there anything else?
There's tokens, a.k.a. peanuts.
Right.
So don't worry, they are 100% legume-free. So,
well, we can't guarantee that, but we're pretty sure.
The wood is 100% legume free. I don't know what's in the paint. And tokens go on players and equipment. A lot of the new players have like token abilities where, you know, hey, for every strike this player gets in the pitch count, add a token to it, and then his MVP is remove tokens to do certain abilities. A lot of equipment has tokens on it, kind of wear and tear of that piece of equipment. So like a rosin bag, because there's only so much talcum powder inside of them. Things like that. So as you use it over time, you get rid of tokens. But every time you do, it's at a benefit to yourself. So, and then if you added on the giant 36 inches by 22 inch tall playmat, you can use the tokens to track your score if you want to do a full 9-inning game, the current inning. There's a lot of different uses you can use for that. So, yeah.
Well, mostly the thing you'll use it for is playing the game.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I mean, like, you know, tracking score on the game, because there's little score tracks on the big playmat, too, and there's a bunch of stuff.
There's so much to this expansion that we had to cut out part of it.
Yeah, we did. For the better.
Yeah, for the better. I mean, we had mentioned before in previous podcasts and one that we want, I guess a couple of backers have mentioned it. The 3- and 4-player expansion for Bottom of the Ninth, we didn't feel like it was really fully cooked, and we want to make sure that when we introduce something, especially in a game that is a 2-player primarily game, we want to make sure that it makes sense thematically to do that, and that a lot of players don't have the downtime. So we have chosen to pull that back, and you know what? You come out, you back Bottom of the Ninth Clubhouse expansion. Our next expansion, which we hope to do because this has been very successful, will be 3- and 4-player expansions.
All right, that's it for this episode of State of Games. We'll be back next time with more great board game discussion. And we really want to hear from you and provide content that you want to hear. So please send us ideas for show topics that you'd like us to cover and new segments that you'd like to hear. Look, you can always email us your ideas at thestateofgames@gmail.com, or you can tweet them directly to us at @thestateofgames. You can also go to dicehateme.com and comment on the podcast, or join BGG Guild 1903 on BoardGameGeek.com.
Thanks, Daryl.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. You can also hit me up on Twitter at DiceHateMe. What about the rest of you?
You can find me at Twitter at GetLouder.
I'm at PuppyShogun on Twitter, and thanks everybody for, if you've played my games at Unpub, you're super sweet, gave me a lot of feedback, and honestly, if other game designers are out there looking to go to Unpub for Unpub 7, I got like 17 playtests in, so totally sweet.
And you can find me on Twitter at JJAYESS1.
All right. Well, until next time, this is Dice Hate Me.
This is Get Louder.
This is Bubby Shogun.
And this is JJS1.
Saying thanks for listening, and may all your rolls be sixes.
Or Cthulhu heads.
Hmm.
Inside joke.
Tentacles.
No, tentacles are subpar Cthulhu heads.
Popcorn.
Squirrel.
Squirrel. All right, we are live. We are recording. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. No more beatboxing. Let's go. Here we go.
Yeah. Welcome to the State of Games.
Get on up. All right. Done. We're recording. Here we go. All right. So come out, go to Kickstarter, search for Bottom of the Ninth or Clubhouse Expansion or whatever you want to search for. Sorry.
Yeah, the Skype messages always.
I know, they make me stop. Oh.
Why?
Because I see them, I'm like, I got to read them, and I'm like, I'm interrupted. Anyway, here's a part where you get to edit out, Jessica. All right. That's it for this episode of State of Games. We'll be back next time with more great board game discussion. We have no idea what's going to be right now, but hey, we like to play by the seat of our pants, right?
No.
No. Yeah, exactly. Jessica's like, no, I have to edit this stuff. Anyway, let me do that again. Sorry. I had this written down. I have it written down outside the notes.
I liked your dramatic reading there.
Oh,
drawing really? A character.
Fine, I'm going to leave it up until next podcast. All right, here, okay. Let me do it again. Here we go. Because this is stupid. I'm tired. All right. Well, that's it for this episode.
You want me to do it?
Yeah, sure, go.
Well, that's it for this episode of the State of Games. We'll be back next time with more great board game discussion. And we really want to hear from you and what... Because you help us. Okay. There's too many adverbs. Oh.